is harmlessly on his shoulder and snapped the free cuff around the door handle of the car. He turned around and Norris was there. He had time to register the fact that Norris looked terrible, just terrible, and to dismiss it as a consequence of being rammed amidships by the head selectman. "Come on," he said to Norris. "We've got trouble." But Norris ignored him, at least for the moment. He brushed past Allen and punched Buster Keaton squarely in the eye. Buster let out a startled squawk and fell back against the door of his car. It was still open, and his weight drove it shut, catching the tail of his sweat-soaked white shirt in the latch. "That's for the rat trap, you fat shit," Norris cried. "I'll get you," Buster screamed back. "Don't think I won't. I'll get all of you people."
"Get this,"
Norris growled. He was moving in again with his fists cocked at the sides of his puffed-up pigeon chest when Allen grabbed him and hauled him back. "Quit it," he shouted into Norris's face. "We've got trouble inside. Bad trouble." The scream lifted in the air again. People were gathering on the sidewalks of Lower Main Street now. Norris looked toward them, then back at Allen. His eyes had cleared, Allen saw with relief, and he looked like himself again, more or less. "What is it, Allen? Something to do with him?" He jerked his chin toward the Cadillac. Buster was standing there, looking sullenly at them and plucking at the handcuff on his wrist with his free hand. He seemed not to have heard the screams at all. "No," Allen said, "not a thing. Have you got your gun?" Norris shook his head. Allen unsnapped the safety strap on his holster, drew his Service 38, and handed it to Norris. "What about you, Allen?" Norris asked. "I want my hands free. Come on, let's go. Hugh Priest is in the office, and he's gone crazy." Hugh Priest had gone crazy, all right, not much doubt about that, but he was a good 3 miles from the Castle Rock Municipal Building. "Let's talk about..." he began, and that was when Henry Beaufort leaped up from behind the bar like a jack-in-the-box, blood soaking the right side of his shirt, the shotgun leveled. Henry and Hugh fired at the same time. The crack of the automatic pistol was lost in the shotgun's blurred primal roar. Smoke and fire leaped from the truncated barrel. Hugh was lifted off his feet and driven across the room, bare heels dragging, his chest a disintegrating swamp of red muck. The gun flew out of his hand. The ends of the foxtail were burning. Henry was thrown against the back bar as Hugh's bullet punctured his right lung. Bottles tumbled and crashed all around him. A large numbness swarmed through his chest. He dropped the shotgun and staggered toward the telephone. The air was full of crazy perfume, spilled booze and burning fox hair. Henry tried to draw in breath, and although his chest heaved, he seemed to get no air. There was a thin, shrill sound as the hole in his chest sucked wind. The telephone seemed to weigh 1,000 pounds, but he finally got it to his ear and pressed the button which automatically dialed the sheriff's office. Ring, ring, ring.
"What the fuck's the matter with you people?" Henry gasped raggedly. "I'm dying up here. Answer the goddamn telephone."
But the telephone just went on ringing. Norris caught up with Allen halfway down the alley, and they walked side by side into the municipal building's small parking lot. Norris was holding Allen's service revolver with his finger curled around the trigger guard and the stubby barrel pointed up into the hot October sky. Sheila Brigham Saab was in the lot alongside Unit 4, John LaPointe's cruiser, but that was all. Allen wondered briefly where Hugh's car was, and then the side door to the sheriff's office burst open. Someone carrying the shotgun from Allen's office in a pair of bloody hands bolted out. Norris leveled the short-barreled 38 and slid his finger inside the trigger guard. Allen registered 2 things at once. The first was that Norris was going to shoot. The second was that the screaming person with the gun was not Hugh Priest, but Sheila Brigham. Alan Pangborn's almost heavenly reflexes saved Sheila's life that afternoon, but it was a very close thing. He didn't bother trying to shout or even using his hand to deflect the pistol's barrel. Neither would have stood much chance of success. He stuck out his elbow instead, then jerked it up like a man doing an enthusiastic buck and wing at a country dance. It struck Norris's gun hand an instant before Norris fired, driving the barrel upward. The pistol shot was an amplified whip crack in the enclosed courtyard. A window in the town services office on the second floor shattered. Then Sheila dropped the shotgun she had used to brain Lester Pratt and was running toward them, screaming and weeping.
"Jesus,"
Norris said in a small, shocked voice. His face was as pale as paper as he thrust the pistol butt first toward Allen.
"I almost shot Sheila. Oh, dear Jesus Christ. Alan! Sheila was crying. Thank God!
She ran into him without slowing, almost knocking him over. He holstered his revolver and then put his arms around her. She was trembling like an electric wire with too much current running through it. Alan suspected he was trembling pretty badly himself, and he had come close to wetting his pants. She was hysterical, blind with panic, and that was probably a blessing. He didn't think she had the slightest idea how close she had come to taking a round. "What's going on in there, Sheila?" he asked. "Tell me quick." His ears were ringing so badly from the gunshot and the succeeding echo that he could almost swear he heard a telephone somewhere. Henry Beaufort felt like a snowman melting in the sun. His legs were giving way beneath him. He crumpled slowly into a kneeling position with the ringing, unanswered phone still tolling in his ear. His head swam with the mingled stench of booze and burning fur. Another hot smell was mingling with these now. He suspected it was Hugh Priest. He was vaguely aware that this wasn't working, and he ought to dial another number for help, but he didn't think he could do it. He was beyond ringing another number out of the telephone. This was it. So he knelt behind the bar, in a growing pool of his own blood, listening to the chimney hoot of air from the hole in his chest, clinging desperately to consciousness. The Tiger didn't open for an hour yet. Billy was dead, and if no one answered this telephone soon, he would also be dead when the first customers came trickling in for their various happy hour potations.
"Please,"
Henry whispered in a screamy, breathless voice.
"Please, answer the phone. Someone please answer this fucking phone."
Sheila Brigham began to regain some control, and Alan got the most important thing out of her right away. She had decommissioned Hugh with the butt of the shotgun. No one was going to try to shoot them when they went through the door. He hoped. "Come on," he said to Norris. "Let's go."
"Alan, when she came out, I thought..."
"I know what you thought, but no harm was done. Forget it, Norris. John's inside. Come on." They went to the door and stood on either side of it. Alan looked at Norris. "Go in low," he said. Norris nodded his head. Alan grabbed the doorknob, jerked the door open, and lunged inside. Norris went in under him in a crouch. John had managed to find his feet and stagger most of the way to the door. Alan and Norris hit him like the front line of the old Pittsburgh Steelers, and John suffered a final, painful indignity. He was knocked flat by his colleagues and sent skidding across the tiled floor like one of the weights in a barroom bowling game. He struck the far wall with a thud and let out a scream of pain which was both surprised and somehow weary.
"Jesus, that's John!" Norris cried. "What a French fire drill!"
"Help me with him," Alan said. They hurried across the room to John, who was slowly sitting up on his own. His face was a mask of blood. His nose was canted severely to the left. His upper lip was swelling like an overinflated inner tube. As Alan and Norris reached him, he cupped one hand under his mouth and spat a tooth into it.
"He's crazy,"
John said in a mushy, dazed voice.
"Sheila hit him with the shotgun. I think she killed him."
"John, are you all right?" Norris asked.
"I'm a fucking mess," John said.
He leaned forward and vomited extravagantly between his own spread legs to prove it. Alan looked around. He was vaguely aware that it wasn't just his ears. A telephone really was ringing. But the phone wasn't the important thing now. He saw Hugh lying face down by the rear wall and went over. He dropped his ear against the back of Hugh's shirt, listening for a heartbeat. All he could hear at first was the ringing in his ears. The goddamn telephones were ringing on every desk, it sounded like.
"Answer that fucking thing or take it off the hook," Alan snapped at Norris.
Norris went to the closest phone, it happened to be on his own desk, punched the button that was flashing and picked it up. "Don't bother us now," he said. "We have an emergency situation here. You'll have to call back later." He dropped it back into its cradle without waiting for a response. Henry Beaufort took the telephone, the heavy, heavy telephone, away from his ear and looked at it with dimming, unbelieving eyes.
"What did you say?"
he whispered. Suddenly, he could no longer hold the telephone receiver. It was just too damned heavy. He dropped it on the floor, slowly collapsed onto his side, and lay there panting. As far as Alan could tell, Hugh was all finished. He grabbed him by the shoulders, rolled him over, and it wasn't Hugh at all. The face was too completely covered with blood, brains, and bits of bone for him to be able to tell who it was, but it surely wasn't Hugh Priest. What in the fuck is going on here? He said in a low, amazed voice. Danforth, Buster Keaton, stood in the middle of the street, handcuffed to his own Cadillac, and watched them watching him. Now that the chief persecutor and his deputy persecutor were gone, they had nothing else to watch. He looked at them and knew them for what they were, each and every one of them. Bill Fullerton and Henry Gendron were standing in front of the barber shop. Bobby Dugas was standing between them with a barber's apron still snapped around his neck and hanging down in front of him like an oversized dinner napkin. Charlie Fortin was standing in front of the Western Auto. Scott Garson and his puke lawyer friends, Albert Martin and Howard Potter, were standing in front of the bank, where they had probably been talking about him when the ruckus broke out. Eyes. Fucking eyes. There were eyes everywhere, all looking at him. I see you, Buster cried suddenly. I see you all you people, and I know what to do. Yes, you bet. He opened the door of his Cadillac and tried to get in. He couldn't do it. He was cuffed to the outside door handle. The chain between the cuffs was long, but not that long. Someone laughed. Buster heard that laugh quite clearly. He looked around. Many residents of Castle Rock stood in front of the businesses along Main Street, looking back at him with the black buckshot eyes of intelligent rats. Everyone was there but Mr. Gaunt. Yet Mr. Gaunt was there. Mr. Gaunt was inside Buster's head, telling him exactly what to do. Buster listened and began to smile. The Budweiser truck Hugh had almost sideswiped in town stopped at a couple of the little mom-and-pop stores on the other side of the bridge and finally pulled into the parking lot of the Mellow Tiger at 4:01 p.m. The driver got out, grabbed his clipboard, hitched up his green khaki pants, and marched toward the building. He stopped 5 feet away from the door, eyes widening. He could see a pair of feet in the bar's doorway. Holy Joe! The driver exclaimed. You okay, buddy? A faint, wheezing cry drifted to his ears.
Help! Help!
The driver ran inside and discovered Henry Beaufort, barely alive, crumpled behind the bar.
It's Lether Pratt, John LaPointe croaked.
Supported by Norris on one side and Sheila on the other, he had hobbled over to where Alan knelt by the body.
Who?
Alan asked. He felt as if he had accidentally stumbled into some mad comedy. Ricky and Lucy go to hell.
Hey, Lester, you got some splainin' to do.
Lether Pratt, John said again with painful patience. He's the physical education teacher at the high school.
What's he doing here? Alan asked.
John LaPointe shook his head wearily. Dunno, Alan. He just came in and went crazy.
Somebody give me a break, Alan said. Where's Hugh Priest? Where's Clutt? What in God's name is going on here?
George T. Nelson stood in the doorway of his bedroom, looking around unbelievingly. The place looked as if some punk band, the Sex Pistols, maybe the Cramps, had had a party in it, along with all their fans.
What?
He began and could say no more. Nor did he need to. He knew what. It was the coke. Had to be. He had been dealing among the faculty at Castle Rock High for the last 6 years. Not all the teachers were appreciators of what Ace sometimes called Bolivian bingo dust, but the ones who were qualified as big appreciators. And he left half an ounce of almost pure coke under the mattress. It was the blow, sure it was. Someone had talked, and someone else had gotten greedy. George supposed he'd known that as soon as he pulled into the driveway and saw the broken kitchen window. He crossed the room and yanked up the mattress with hands that felt dead and numb. Nothing underneath. The coke was gone. Nearly $2,000 worth of almost pure coke. Gone. He sleepwalked toward the bathroom to see if his own small stash was still in the Anison bottle on the top shelf of the medicine cabinet. He'd never needed a hit as badly as he did just now. He reached the doorway and stopped, eyes wide. It wasn't the mess that riveted his attention, although this room had also been turned upside down with great zeal. It was the toilet. The ring was down, and it was thinly dusted with white stuff. George had an idea that white stuff was not Johnson's baby powder. He walked across to the toilet, wetted his finger, and touched it to the dust. He put his finger in his mouth. The tip of his tongue went numb almost at once. Lying on the floor between the John and the tub was an empty plastic baggie. The picture was clear. Crazy, but clear. Someone had come in, found the Coke, and then flushed it down the crapper. Why? Why? He didn't know. But he decided when he found the person who had done this, he would ask, just before he tore his head right off his shoulders. It couldn't hurt. His own 3-gram stash was intact. He carried it out of the bathroom and then stopped again as a fresh shock struck his eyes. He hadn't seen this particular abomination as he crossed the bedroom from the hall, but from this angle, it was impossible to miss. He stood where he was for a long moment, eyes wide with amazed horror, his throat working convulsively. The nests of veins at his temples beat rapidly, like the wings of small birds. He finally managed to produce one small, strangled word.
Mom!
Downstairs, behind George T. Nelson's oatmeal-colored sofa, Frank Jewett slept on. The bystanders on Lower Main, who had been called out to the sidewalk by the yelling and the gunshot, were now being entertained by a new novelty, the slow-motion escape of their head selectman. Buster leaned as far into his Cadillac as he could and turned the ignition switch to the on position. He then pushed the button that lowered the power window on the driver's side. He closed the door again and carefully began to wriggle in through the window. He was still sticking out from the knees down, his left arm pulled back behind him at a severe angle by the handcuff around the door handle, the chain lying across his large left thigh, when Scott Garson came up. Danforth, the banker said hesitantly, I don't think you're supposed to do that. I believe you're arrested. Buster looked under his right armpit, smelling his own aroma, quite spicy by now, quite spicy indeed, and saw Garson upside down. He was standing directly behind Buster. He looked as if he might be planning to try to haul Buster back out of his own car. Buster pulled his legs up as much as he could and then shot them out hard, like a pony kicking up Dickens in the pasture. The heels of his shoes struck Garson's face with a smack which Buster found entirely satisfying. Garson's gold-rimmed spectacles shattered. He howled, reeled backward with his bleeding face in his hands, and fell on his back in Main Street. Ha! Buster grunted. Didn't expect that, did you? Didn't expect that at all, you persecuting son of a bitch, did you? He wriggled the rest of the way into his car. There was just enough chain. His shoulder joint creaked alarmingly and then rotated enough in its socket to allow him to wriggle under his own arm and scoot his ass back along the seat. Now he was sitting behind the wheel with his cuffed arm out the window. He started the car. Scott Garson sat up in time to see the Cadillac bearing down on him. Its grill seemed to leer at him, a vast chrome mountain which was going to crush him. He rolled frantically to the left, avoiding death by less than a second. One of the Cadillac's large front tires rolled over his right hand, squashing it pretty efficiently. Then the rear tire rolled over it, finishing the job. Garson lay on his back, looking at his grotesquely mashed fingers, which were now roughly the size of putty knives, and began to scream up into the hot blue sky. Tammy Faye! This shriek hauled Frank Jewett out of his deepening doze. He had absolutely no idea where he was in those first confused seconds, only that it was in some tight, close place, an unpleasant place. There was something in his hand, too. What was it? He raised his right hand and almost poked out his own eye with the steak knife.
Oh, no! Tammy Faye!
It came back to him all at once. He was behind the couch of his good old friend, George T. Nelson, and that was George T. Nelson himself, in the flesh, noisily mourning his dead parakeet. Along with this realization, everything else returned to Frank. The magazines scattered all over the office, the blackmail note, the possible, no, probable. The more he thought about it, the more probable it seemed. Ruin of his career and his life. Now, incredibly, he could hear George T. Nelson sobbing, sobbing over a goddamn flying shithouse. Well, Frank thought, I'm going to put you out of your misery, George. Who knows, maybe you'll even wind up in bird heaven. The sobs were approaching the sofa, better and better. He would jump up, surprise, George, and the bastard would be dead before he had any idea what was up. Frank was on the verge of making a spring when George T. Nelson, still sobbing as if his heart would break, dropped onto his sofa. He was a heavy man, and his weight drove the sofa back smartly toward the wall. He did not hear the surprised, breathless "oof" from behind him. His own sobs covered it. He fumbled for the telephone, dialed through a shimmer of tears, and got, almost miraculously, Fred Rubin on the first ring.
"Fred!" he cried. "Fred, something terrible has happened. Maybe it's still happening. Oh, Jesus, Fred. Oh, Jesus."
Below and behind him, Frank Jewett was struggling for breath. Edgar Allan Poe stories he'd read as a kid, stories about being buried alive, raced through his head. His face was slowly turning the color of old brick. The heavy wooden leg, which had been forced against his chest when George T. Nelson collapsed onto the sofa, felt like a bar of lead. The back of the sofa lay against his shoulder and the side of his face. Above him, George T. Nelson was spilling a garbled description of what he'd found when he finally got home into Fred Rubin's ear. At last he paused for a moment and then cried out,
"I don't care if I shouldn't be talking about it on the phone. How can I care when he killed Tammy Faye? The bastard killed Tammy Faye. Who could have done it, Fred? Who? You have to help me."
Another pause as George T. Nelson listened. And Frank realized with growing panic that he was soon going to pass out. He suddenly understood what he had to do, use the Llama automatic to shoot up through the sofa. He might not kill George T. Nelson, he might not even hit George T. Nelson, but he could sure as hell get George T. Nelson's attention, and once he did that, he thought the odds were good that George T. Nelson would get his fat ass off this sofa before Frank died down here with his nose squashed against the baseboard heating unit. Frank opened the hand holding the steak knife and tried to reach for the pistol tucked into the waistband of his pants. Dreamlike horror washed through him as he realized he couldn't get it. His fingers were opening and closing 2 full inches above the gun's ivory inlaid handle. He tried with all his remaining strength to get the hand down lower, but his pinned shoulder would not move at all. The big sofa and George T. Nelson's considerable weight held it firmly against the wall. It might have been nailed there. Black roses, harbingers of approaching asphyxiation, began to bloom before Frank's bulging eyes. As from some impossible distance, he heard his old friend screaming at Fred Rubin, who undoubtedly had been George T. Nelson's partner in the cocaine deal.
"What are you talking about? I called to tell you I've been violated, and you tell me to go see the new guy down street? I don't need knickknacks, Fred. I need..."
He broke off, got up, and paced across the room. With what was literally the last of his strength, Frank managed to push the sofa a few inches away from the wall. It wasn't much, but he was able to take small sips of incredibly wonderful air.
"He sells what?" George T. Nelson shouted. "Well, Jesus! Jesus H. Christ! Why didn't you say so in the first place?"
Silence again. Frank lay behind the sofa like a beached whale, sipping air and hoping his monstrously pounding head would not explode. In a moment, he would arise and blow his old friend, George T. Nelson's faucets off. In a moment, when he got his breath back, and when the big black flowers currently filling his sight shrank back into nothing. In a moment, 2 at the most.
"Okay," George T. Nelson said, "I'll go see him. I doubt if he's the miracle worker you think he is, but any goddamn port in a storm, right? I have to tell you something, though. I don't give much of a shit if he's dealing or not. I'm going to find the son of a bitch who did this. That's the first goddamn order of business, and I'm going to nail him to the nearest wall. Have you got that?"
I got it, Frank thought. But just who nails who to that fabled wall still remains to be seen, my dear old party buddy.
"Yes, I did get the name," George T. Nelson screamed into the phone. "Gaunt, Gaunt, fucking Gaunt!"
He slammed the phone down, then must have thrown it across the room. Frank heard the shatter of breaking glass. Seconds later, George T. Nelson uttered a final oath and stormed out of the house. The engine of his IROC Z raved to life. Frank heard him backing down the driveway as he himself slowly pushed the sofa away from the wall. Rubber screamed against pavement outside. And then Frank's old friend, George T. Nelson, was gone. 2 minutes later, a pair of hands rose into view and clutched the back of the oatmeal-colored sofa. A moment after that, the face of Frank M. Jewett, pale and crazed, the rimless Mr. Weatherby glasses sitting askew on his small pug nose and one lens cracked, appeared between the hands. the sofa back and left a red stippled pattern on his right cheek. A few dust bunnies danced in his thinning hair. Slowly, like a bloated corpse rising from the bed of a river until it floats just below the surface, the grin reappeared on Frank's face. He had missed his old friend, George T. Nelson, this time, but George T. Nelson had no plans to leave town. His phone conversation had made that quite clear. Frank would find him before the day was over. In a town the size of Castle Rock, how could he miss? Sean Rusk stood in the kitchen doorway of his house, looking anxiously out at the garage. 5 minutes before, his older brother had gone out there. Sean had been looking out of his bedroom window and had just happened to see him. Brian had been holding something in one hand. The distance had been too great for Sean to see what it was, but he didn't need to see. He knew. It was the new baseball card, the one Brian kept creeping upstairs to look at. Brian didn't know Sean knew about that card, but Sean did. He even knew who was on it, because he'd gotten home much earlier from school today than Brian, and he had sneaked into Brian's room to look at it. He didn't have the slightest idea why Brian cared about it so much. It was old, dirty, dog-eared, and faded. Also, the player was somebody Sean had never heard of, a pitcher for the Los Angeles Dodgers named Sammy Coburg. Lifetime record, 1 win, 3 losses. The guy had never even spent a whole year in the majors. Why would Brian care about a worthless card like that? Sean didn't know. He only knew 2 things for sure. Brian did care, and the way Brian had been acting for the last week or so was scary. It was like those TV ads you saw about kids on drugs. But Brian wouldn't use drugs, would he? Something about Brian's face when he went out to the garage had scared Sean so badly he had gone to tell his mother. He wasn't sure exactly what to say, and it turned out not to matter because he didn't get a chance to say anything. She was mooning around in the bedroom, wearing her bathrobe and those stupid sunglasses from the new store downtown. "Mom, Brian's," he began, and that was as far as he got. "Go away, Sean. Mommy's busy right now." "But, Mom..." "Go away," I said. And before he had a chance to go on his own, he'd found himself hustled unceremoniously out of the bedroom. Her bathrobe fell open as she pushed him, and before he could look away, he saw that she was wearing nothing beneath it, not even a nightgown. She had slammed the door behind him and locked it. Now, he stood in the kitchen doorway, waiting anxiously for Brian to come back out of the garage, but Brian didn't. His unease had grown in some stealthy way until it was barely controlled terror. Sean went out the kitchen door, trotted through the breezeway, and entered the garage. It was dark and oily-smelling and explosively hot inside. For a moment, he didn't see his brother in the shadows and thought he must have gone out through the back door into the yard. Then his eyes adjusted, and he uttered a small, whimpery gasp. Brian was sitting against the rear wall next to the lawn boy. He had gotten Daddy's rifle. The butt was propped on the floor. The muzzle was pointed at his own face. Brian was supporting the barrel with one hand, while the other clutched the dirty old baseball card which had somehow gained such a hold over his life this last week. "Brian," Sean cried, "what are you doing?" "Don't come any closer, Sean. You'll get the mess on you."
"Brian, don't," Sean cried, beginning to weep. "Don't be such a wussy. You're scaring me."
"I want you to promise me something," Brian said. He had taken off his socks and sneakers, and now he wriggled one of his big toes into the Remington's trigger guard. Sean felt his crotch grow wet and warm. He had never been so scared in his life.
"Brian, please, please."
"I want you to promise me you'll never go to the new store," Brian said. "Do you hear me?" Sean took a step toward his brother. Brian's toe tightened on the trigger of the rifle.
"No!"
Sean screamed, drawing back at once.
"I mean, yes! Yes!"
Brian let the barrel drop a little when he saw his brother retreat. His toe relaxed a bit. "Promise me."
"Yes! Anything you want! Only, don't do that! Don't tease me anymore, Bri! Let's go in and watch the Transformers! No, you pick! Anything you want! Even Wapner! We can watch Wapner if you want to. All week. All month. I'll watch with you. Only stop scaring me, Brian. Please stop scaring me."
Brian Rusk might not have heard. His eyes seemed to float in his distant, serene face. "Never go there," he said. Needful Things is a poison place, and Mr. Gaunt is a poison man. Only he's really not a man, Sean. He's not a man at all. Swear to me you'll never buy any of the poison things Mr. Gaunt sells.
I swear, Sean babbled. I swear on Mommy's name.
No, Brian said. You can't do that because he got her, too. Swear on your own name, Sean. Swear it on your very own name.
I do,
Sean cried out in the hot, dim garage. He held his hands out imploringly to his brother.
I really do. I swear on my very own name. Now, please put the gun down, Brian.
I love you, baby brother, Brian said. He looked down at the baseball card for a moment. Sandy Koufax sucks, Brian Rusk remarked, and pulled the trigger with his toe. Sean's drilling shriek of horror rose over the blast, which was flat and loud in the hot, dark garage. Leland Gaunt stood at his shop window, looking out on Main Street and smiling gently. The sound of the shot from up on Ford Street was faint, but his ears were sharp, and he heard it. His smile broadened a little. He took down the sign in the window, the one which said he was open by appointment only, and put up a new one. This one read, "Closed until further notice." "We're having fun now," Leland Gaunt said to no one at all. "Yes, sirree." Polly Chalmers knew nothing of these things. While Castle Rock was bearing the first real fruits of Mr. Gaunt's labors, she was out at the end of Town Road No. 3, at the old Camber place. She had gone there as soon as she had finished her conversation with Alan. "Finished it?" she thought. "Oh, my dear, that's much too civilized, after you hung up on him. Isn't that what you mean?" "All right," she agreed, "after I hung up on him. But he went behind my back, and when I called him on it, he got all flustered and then lied about it. He lied about it. I happen to think that behavior like that deserves an uncivilized response." Something stirred uneasily in her at this, something which might have spoken if she had given it time and room, but she gave it neither. She wanted no dissenting voices, did not, in fact, want to think about her last conversation with Alan Pangborn at all. She just wanted to take care of her business out here at the end of Town Road No. 3 and then go home. Once she was there, she intended to take a cool bath and then go to bed for 12 or 16 hours. That deep voice managed just 5 words. "But, Polly, have you thought?" No, she hadn't. She supposed she would have to think in time, but now was too soon. When the thinking began, the hurting would begin, too. For now, she only wanted to take care of business and not think at all. The Camber place was spooky, reputed by some to be haunted. Not so many years ago, 2 people, a small boy and Sheriff George Bannerman, had died in the dooryard of this house. 2 others, Gary Pervier and Joe Camber himself, had died just down the hill. Polly parked her car over the place where a woman named Donna Trenton had once made the fatal mistake of parking her Ford Pinto and got out. The Ozka swung back and forth between her breasts as she did. She looked around uneasily for a moment at the sagging porch, the paintless walls overrun by climbing ivy, the windows which were mostly broken and stared blindly back at her. Crickets sang their stupid songs in the grass, and the hot sun beat down as it had on those terrible days when Donna Trenton had fought for her life here and for the life of her son. "What am I doing here?" Polly thought. "What in God's name am I doing here?" But she knew, and it had nothing to do with Alan Pangborn or Kelton or the San Francisco Department of Child Welfare. This little field trip had nothing to do with love. It had to do with pain. That was all, but that was enough. There was something inside the small silver charm, something that was alive. If she did not live up to her side of the bargain she had made with Leland Gaunt, it would die. She didn't know if she could stand to be tumbled back down into the horrible, grinding pain to which she had awakened on Sunday morning. If she had to face a lifetime of such pain, she thought she would kill herself. "And it's not Alan," she whispered as she walked toward the barn with its gaping doorway and its ominous sway-backed roof. "He said he wouldn't raise a hand against him. Why do you even care? That worrisome voice whispered. She cared because she didn't want to hurt Alan. She was angry at him, yes, furious, in fact. But that didn't mean she had to stoop to his level, that she had to treat him as shabbily as he had treated her. But, Polly, have you thought? No. No! She was going to play a trick on Ace Merrill, and she didn't care about Ace at all, had never even met him, only knew him by reputation. The trick was on Ace, but Alan, who had sent Ace Merrill away to Shawshank, came into it someplace. Her heart told her so. And could she back out of this? Could she, even if she wanted to? Now it was Kelton as well. Mr. Gaunt hadn't exactly told her that the news of what had happened to her son would end up all over town unless she did what he told her to do. But he had hinted as much. She couldn't bear for that to happen. Is a woman not entitled to her pride? When everything else is gone, is she not at least entitled to this, the coin without which her purse is entirely empty? Yes, and yes, and yes. Mr. Gaunt had told her she'd find the only tools she would need in the barn. Now Polly began to walk slowly in that direction. Go where ye list, but go there alive, Tricia, Aunt Evie had told her. Don't be no ghost. But now, stepping into the camber barn through doors which hung gaping and frozen on their rusty tracks, she felt like a ghost. She had never felt more like a ghost in her life. The Oscar moved between her breasts, on its own now. Something inside, something alive. She didn't like it, but she liked the idea of what would happen if that thing died even less. She would do what Mr. Gaunt had told her to do, at least this once, cut all her ties with Alan Pangborn. It had been a mistake to ever begin with him. She saw that now, saw it clearly. And keep her past, her own. Why not? After all, it was such a little thing. The shovel was exactly where he had told her it would be, leaning against one wall in a dusty shaft of sunlight. She took hold of its smooth, worn handle. Suddenly she seemed to hear a low, purring growl from the deep shadows of the barn, as if the rabid St. Bernard, which had killed Big George Bannerman and caused the death of Tad Trenton, were still here, back from the dead and meaner than ever. Goose flesh danced up her arms, and Polly left the barn in a hurry. The dooryard was not exactly cheery, not with that empty house glaring sullenly at her, but it was better than the barn. What am I doing here? Her mind asked again, woefully, and it was Aunt Evie's voice that came back. Goin' ghost, that's what you're doing. You're goin' ghost. Polly squeezed her eyes shut. Stop it, she whispered fiercely. Just stop it. That's right, Leland Gaunt said. Besides, what's the big deal? It's only a harmless little joke, and if something serious were to come of it, it won't, of course, but just supposing, for the sake of argument, that it did, whose fault would that be? Alan's, she whispered. Her eyes rolled nervously in their sockets, and her hands clenched and unclenched nervously between her breasts. If he were here to talk to, if he hadn't cut himself off from me by snooping around in things that are none of his business... The little voice tried to speak up again, but Leland Gaunt cut it off before it could say a word. Right again, Gaunt said. As to what you're doing here, Polly, the answer to that is simple enough. You're paying. That's what you're doing, and that's all you're doing. Ghosts have nothing to do with it. And remember this, because it is the simplest, most wonderful aspect of commerce. Once an item is paid for, it belongs to you. You didn't expect such a wonderful thing to come cheap, did you? But when you finish paying, it's yours. You have a clear title to the thing you have paid for. Now will you stand here listening to those old frightened voices all day, or will you do what you came to do? Polly opened her eyes again. The Oscar hung movelessly at the end of its chain. If it had moved, and she was no longer sure it had stopped now. The house was just a house, empty too long and showing the inevitable signs of neglect. The windows were not eyes, but simply holes rendered glassless by adventuresome boys with rocks. If she had heard something in the barn, and she was no longer sure she had, it had only been the sound of a board expanding in the unseasonable October heat. Her parents were dead. Her sweet little boy was dead. And the dog, which had ruled this dooryard so terribly and completely for 3 summer days and nights 11 years ago, was dead. There were no ghosts.
"Not even me,"
she said, and began to walk around the barn.
"When you go around to the back of the barn,"
Mr. Gaunt had said,
"you'll see the remains of an old trailer."
She did. A silver-sided airflow, almost obscured by goldenrod and high tangles of late sunflowers.
"You'll see a large flat rock at the left end of the trailer."
She found it easily. It was as large as a garden paving stone.
"Move the rock and dig. About 2 feet down, you'll find a Crisco can."
She tossed the rock aside and dug. Less than 5 minutes after she started, the shovel's blade clunked on the can. She discarded the shovel and dug into the loose earth with her fingers, breaking the light webwork of roots with her fingers. A minute later, she was holding the Crisco can. It was rusty but intact. The rotting label came loose, and she saw a recipe for pineapple surprise cake on the back. The list of ingredients was mostly obscured by a black blotch of mold, along with a biscuit coupon that had expired in 1969. She got her fingers under the lid of the can and pried it loose. The whiff of air that escaped made her wince and draw her head back for a moment. That voice tried one last time to ask what she was doing here, but Polly shut it out. She looked into the can and saw what Mr. Gaunt had told her she would see, a bundle of gold bond trading stamps and several fading photographs of a woman having sexual intercourse with a collie dog. She took these things out, stuffed them into her hip pocket, and then wiped her fingers briskly on the leg of her jeans. She would wash her hands as soon as she could, she promised herself. Touching these things, which had lain so long under the earth, made her feel unclean. From her other pocket, she took a sealed business envelope. Typed on the front in capital letters was this: "A message for the intrepid treasure hunter." Polly put the envelope in the can, pressed the cover back down, and dropped it into the hole again. She used the shovel to fill in the hole, working quickly and carelessly. All she wanted right now was to get the hell out of here. When she was done, she walked away fast. The shovel she slung into the high weeds. She had no intention of taking it back to the barn, no matter how mundane the explanation of the sound she had heard might be. When she reached her car, she opened first the passenger door and then the glove compartment. She pawed through the litter of paper inside until she found an old book of matches. It took her 4 tries to produce 1 small flame. The pain had almost entirely left her hands, but they were shaking so badly that she struck the first 3 much too hard, bending the paper heads uselessly to the side. When the 4th flared alight, she held it between 2 fingers of her right hand, the flame almost invisible in the hot afternoon sunlight, and took the matted pile of trading stamps and dirty pictures from her jeans pocket. She touched the flame to the bundle and held it there until she was sure it had caught. Then she cast the match aside and dipped the papers down to produce maximum draft. The woman was malnourished and hollow-eyed. The dog looked mangy and just smart enough to be embarrassed. It was a relief to watch the surface of the 1 photograph she could see bubble and turn brown. When the pictures began to curl up, she dropped the flaming bundle into the dirt where a woman had once beaten another dog, this one a St. Bernard, to death with a baseball bat. The flames flared. The little pile of stamps and photos quickly crumpled to black ash. The flames guttered, went out, and at the moment they did, a sudden gust of wind blew through the stillness of the day, breaking the clot of ash up into flakes. They whirled upward in a funnel, which Polly followed with eyes that had suddenly gone wide and frightened. Where exactly had that freak gust of wind come from?
"Oh, please, can't you stop being so damp?"
At that moment, the growling sound, low, like an idling outboard motor, rose from the hot, dark maw of the barn again. It wasn't her imagination, and it wasn't a creaking board. It was a dog. Polly looked that way, frightened, and saw 2 sunken red circles of light peering out at her from the darkness. She ran around the car, bumping her hip painfully against the right side of the hood in her hurry, got in, rolled up the windows, and locked the doors. She turned the ignition key. The engine cranked over, but did not start.
"No one knows where I am," she realized. "No one but Mr. Gaunt, and he wouldn't tell."
For a moment, she imagined herself trapped out here, the way Donna Trenton and her son had been trapped. Then the engine burst into life, and she backed out of the driveway so fast she almost ran her car into the ditch on the far side of the road. She dropped the transmission into drive and headed back to town as fast as she dared to go. She had forgotten all about washing her hands. Ace Merrill rolled out of bed around the same time that Brian Rusk was blowing his head off 30 miles away. He went into the bathroom, shucking out of his dirty skivvies as he walked and urinated for an hour or two. He raised one arm and sniffed his pit. He looked at the shower and decided against it. He had a big day ahead of him. The shower could wait. He left the bathroom without bothering to flush. If it's yellow, let it mellow was an integral part of Ace's philosophy, and went directly to the bureau, where the last of Mr. Gaunt's blow was laid out on a shaving mirror. It was great stuff, easy on the nose, hot in the head. It was also almost gone. Ace had needed a lot of go power last night, just as Mr. Gaunt had said, but he had a pretty good idea there was more where this had come from. Ace used the edge of his driver's license to shape a couple of lines. He snorted them with a rolled-up $5 bill, and something that felt like a Shrike missile went off in his head. Boom! Cried Ace Merrill in his best Warner Wolf voice. Let's go to the videotape! He pulled a pair of faded jeans up over his naked hips and then got into a Harley-Davidson t-shirt. It's what all the well-dressed treasure hunters are wearing this year, he thought, and laughed wildly. My, that coke was fine. He was on his way out the door when his eye fell on last night's take, and he remembered that he had meant to call Nat Copeland in Portsmouth. He went back into the bedroom, dug through the clothes, which were balled helter-skelter in his top bureau drawer, and finally came up with a battered address book. He went back into the kitchen, sat down, and dialed the number he had. He doubted that he would actually catch Nat in, but it was worth a try. The coke buzzed and whipsawed in his head, but he could already feel the rush tapering off. A headshot of cocaine made a new man of you. The only trouble was, the first thing the new man wanted was another one, and Ace's supply was severely depleted. Yeah? A wary voice said in his ear, and Ace realized he had beaten the odds again. His luck was in. Nat! He cried. Who the fuck says so? I do, old hoss, I do! Ace? That you? None other. How you doing, old Natty? I've been better. Nat sounded less than overjoyed to hear from his old machine shop buddy at Shawshank. What do you want, Ace? Now, is that any way to talk to a pal? Ace asked reproachfully. He cocked the phone between his ear and shoulder and pulled a pair of rusty tin cans toward him. One of them had come out of the ground behind the old Treblehorn place, the other from the cellar hole of the old master's farm, which had burned flat when Ace was only 10 years old. The first can had contained only 4 books of S&H green stamps and several banded packets of Raleigh cigarette coupons. The second had contained a few sheafs of mixed trading stamps and 6 rolls of pennies. Except they didn't look like regular pennies. They were white. Maybe I just wanted to touch base. Ace teased. You know, check on the state of your piles, see how your supply of KY's holding out, things like that. What do you want, Ace? Nat Copeland repeated wearily. Ace plucked one of the penny rolls out of the old Crisco can. The paper had faded from its original purple to a dull wash pink. He shook 2 of the pennies out into his hand and looked at them curiously. If anyone would know about these things, Nat Copeland was the guy. He had once owned a shop in Kittery called Copeland's Coins and Collectibles. He'd also had his own private coin collection, one of the 10 best in New England, at least according to Nat himself. Then he, too, had discovered the wonders of cocaine. In the 4 or 5 years following this discovery, he had dismantled his coin collection item by item and put it up his nose. In 1985, police responding to a silent alarm at the Long John Silver coin shop in Portland had found Nat Copeland in the back room stuffing Lady Liberty silver dollars into a chamois bag. Ace met him not long after. Well, I did have a question now that you mention it. A question? That's all? That's absolutely all, good buddy. All right. Nat's voice relaxed the smallest bit. Ask then. I don't have all day. Right, Ace said. Busy, busy, busy. Places to go and people to eat. Am I right, Natty? He laughed crazily. It wasn't just the blow. It was the day. He hadn't gotten in until first light. The coke he had ingested had kept him awake until almost 10 this morning, in spite of the drawn shades and his physical exertions, and he still felt ready to eat steel bars and spit out 10-penny nails. And why not? Why the fuck not? He was standing on the rim of a fortune. He knew it. He felt it in every fiber. Ace, is there really something on that thing you call your mind, or did you just phone to rag me? No, I didn't call to rag you. Give me the straight dope, Nettie, and I might give you some straight dope. Very straight. Really? Nat Copeland's voice lost its edge at once. It became hushed, almost awed. Are you shitting me, Ace? The best primo shit I ever had, Natty Bumpo, my lad. Can you cut me in? I wouldn't doubt it a bit, Ace said, meaning to do no such thing. He had pried 3 or 4 more of the strange pennies out of their old faded roll. Now he pushed them into a straight line with his finger. But you've got to do me a favor. Name it. What do you know about white pennies? There was a pause on the other end of the line. Then Nat said cautiously, "White pennies? Do you mean steel pennies?" "I don't know what I mean. You're the coin collector, not me." "Look at the dates. See if they're from the years 1941 to 1945. Ace turned over the pennies in front of him. One was a 1941, 4 were 1943s, the last was from 1944. "Yeah, they are. What are they worth, Nat?" He tried to disguise the eagerness in his voice and was not entirely successful. "Not a lot, taken one by one," Nat said, "but a hell of a lot more than ordinary pennies. Maybe $2 apiece, 3 if they're UC. What's that?" "Uncirculated. In mint condition. Have you got a lot, Ace?" "Quite a few," Ace said. "Quite a few, Nanny, my man." But he was disappointed. He had 6 rolls, 300 pennies, and the ones he was looking at didn't look in particularly good shape to him. They weren't exactly beat to shit, but they were a long way from being shiny and new. $600, 800 tops. Not what you'd call a big strike. "Well, bring them down and let me look," Matt said. "I can get you top dollar." He hesitated, then added, "And bring some of that marching powder with you." "I'll think about it," Ace said. "Hey, Ace, don't hang up." "Fuck you very much, Natty," Ace replied, and did just that. He sat where he was for a moment, brooding over the pennies and the 2 rusty cans. There was something very weird about all of this. Useless trading stamps and $600 worth of steel pennies. What did that add up to? That's the bitch of it, Ace thought. It doesn't add up to anything. Where's the real stuff? Where's the goddamn loot? He pushed back from the table, went into the bedroom, and snorted the rest of the blow Mr. Gaunt had laid on him. When he came out again, he had the book with the map in it, and he was feeling considerably more cheerful. It did add up. It added up just fine. Now that he had helped his head a bit, he could see that. After all, there had been lots of crosses on that map. He had found 2 caches right where those crosses suggested they would be, each marked with a large flat stone. Crosses plus flat stones equal buried treasure. It did seem that Pop had been a little softer in his old age than people from town had believed, that he'd had a bit of a problem telling the difference between diamonds and dust there at the end. But the big stuff, gold, currency, maybe negotiable securities, had to be out there someplace under one or more of those flat rocks. He had proved that. His uncle had buried things of value, not just bunches of moldy old trading stamps. At the old master's farm, he had found 6 rolls of steel pennies worth at least $600. Not much, but an indication. "It's out there," Ace said softly. His eyes sparkled madly. "It's all out there, in one of those other 7 holes, or 2, or 3. He knew it. He took the brown paper map out of the book and let his finger wander from one cross to the next, wondering if some were more likely than others. Ace's finger stopped on the old Joe Camber place. It was the only location where there were 2 crosses close together. His finger began to move slowly back and forth between them. Joe Camber had died in a tragedy that had taken 3 other lives. His wife and boy had been away at the time, on vacation. People like the Cambers didn't ordinarily take vacations, but Charity Camber had won some money in the state lottery, Ace seemed to recall. He tried to remember more, but it was hazy in his mind. He'd had his own fish to fry back then, plenty of them. What had Mrs. Camber done when she and her boy had returned from their little trip to find that Joe, a world-class shit, according to everything Ace had heard, was dead and gone? Moved out of state, hadn't they? And the property? Maybe she'd wanted to turn it over in a hurry. In Castle Rock, one name stood above all the rest when it came to turning things over in a hurry. That name was Reginald Marion Pop Merrill. Had she gone to see him? He would have offered her short commons. That was his way. But if she was anxious enough to move, short commons might have been okay with her. In other words, the Camber place might also have belonged to Pop at the time of his death. This possibility solidified to a certainty in Ace's mind only moments after it occurred to him. "The Camber place," he said. "I bet that's where it is. I know that's where it is. Thousands of dollars, maybe tens of thousands. Hopping, Jesus." He snatched up the map and slammed it back into the book. Then he headed out to the Chevy Mr. Gahn had loaned him, almost running. One question still nagged. If Pop really had been able to tell the difference between diamonds and dust, why had he bothered to bury the trading stamps at all? Ace pushed this question impatiently aside and got on the road to Castle Rock. Danforth Keaton arrived back home in Castle View just as Ace was leaving for the town's more rural environs. Buster was still handcuffed to the door handle of his Cadillac, but his mood was one of savage euphoria. He had spent the last 2 years fighting shadows, and the shadows had been winning. It had gotten to the point where he had begun fearing that he might be going insane, which, of course, was just what they wanted him to believe. He saw several satellite dishes on his drive from Main Street to his home on the View. He had noticed them before and had wondered if they might not be a part of what was going on in this town. Now he felt sure. They weren't satellite dishes at all. They were mind disruptors. They might not all be aimed at his house, but you could be sure any which weren't were aimed at the few other people like him who understood that a monstrous conspiracy was afoot. Buster parked in his driveway and pushed the garage door opener clipped to his sun visor. The door began to rise, but he felt a monstrous bolt of pain go through his head at the same instant. He understood that was a part of it, too. They had replaced his real wizard garage door opener with something else, something that shot bad rays into his head at the same time it was opening the door. He pulled it off the visor and threw it out the window before driving into the garage. He turned off the ignition, opened the door, and got out. The handcuff tethered him to the door as efficiently as a choke chain. There were tools mounted neatly on wall pegs, but they were well out of reach. Buster leaned back into the car and began to blow the horn. Myrtle Keaton, who'd had her own errand to run that afternoon, was lying on her bed upstairs in a troubled semi-doze when the horn began to blow. She sat bolt upright, eyes bulging in terror.
"I did it!" she gasped. "I did what you told me to do. Now please leave me alone."
She realized that she had been dreaming, that Mr. Gaunt was not here, and let out her breath in a long, trembling sigh.
Wonk! Wonk! Wonk!
It sounded like the Cadillac's horn. She picked up the doll which lay next to her on the bed, the beautiful doll she had gotten at Mr. Gaunt's shop, and hugged it to her for comfort. She had done something this afternoon, something which a dim, frightened part of her believed to be a bad thing, a very bad thing, and since then the doll had become inexpressibly dear to her. Price, Mr. Gaunt might have said, always enhances value, at least in the eyes of the purchaser.
Wonk!
It was the Cadillac's horn. Why was Danforth sitting in the garage blowing his horn? She supposed she had better go see. But he better not hurt my doll, she said in a low voice. She placed it carefully in the shadows under her side of the bed. He just better not, because that's where I draw the line. Myrtle was one of a great many people who had visited Needful Things that day, just another name with a check mark beside it on Mr. Gaunt's list. She had come, like many others, because Mr. Gaunt had told her to come. She got the message in a way her husband would have understood completely. She heard it in her head. Mr. Gaunt had told her the time had come to finish paying for her doll, if she wanted to keep it, that was. She was to take a metal box and a sealed letter to the Daughters of Isabella Hall next to Our Lady of Serene Waters. The box had grills set in every side but the bottom. She could hear a faint ticking noise from inside. She had tried to look into one of the round grills. They looked like the speakers in old-fashioned table radios, but she had been able to see only a vague cube-shaped object. And in truth, she hadn't looked very hard. It seemed better, safer, not to. There had been one car in the parking lot of the little church complex when Myrtle, who was on foot, arrived. The parish hall itself had been empty, though. She peeked over the sign taped to the window set in the top half of the door to make sure, then read the sign. Daughters of Isabella meet Tuesday at 7 p.m. Help us plan casino night. Myrtle slipped inside. To her left was a stack of brightly painted compartments standing against the wall. This was where the daycare children kept their lunches and where the Sunday school children kept their various drawings and work projects. Myrtle had been told to put her item into one of these compartments, and she did so. It just fit. At the front of the room was the chairwoman's table, with an American flag on the left and a banner depicting the Infant of Prague on the right. The table was already set up for the evening meeting, with pens, pencils, casino night sign-up sheets, and, in the middle, the chairwoman's agenda. Myrtle had put the envelope Mr. Gaunt had given her under the sheet so Betsy Vigue, this year's Daughters of Isabella Activities chairwoman, would see it as soon as she picked up her agenda. "Read this right away, you pope whore," was typed across the front of the envelope in capital letters. Heart bumping rapidly in her chest, her blood pressure somewhere over the moon, Myrtle had tiptoed out of the Daughters of Isabella hall. She paused for a moment outside, hand pressed above her ample bosom, trying to catch her breath, and saw someone hurrying out of the Knights of Columbus hall beyond the church. It was June Gavinoe. She looked as scared and guilty as Myrtle felt. She raced down the wooden steps to the parking lot so fast she almost fell, and then walked rapidly toward that single-parked car, low heels tip-tapping briskly on the hot top. She looked up, saw Myrtle, and paled. Then she looked more closely at Myrtle's face and understood. "You too?" she asked in a low voice. A strange grin, both jolly and nauseated, rose on her face. It was the expression of a normally well-behaved child who has, for reasons she does not understand herself, put a mouse in her favorite teacher's desk drawer. Myrtle felt an answering grin of exactly the same type rise on her own face, yet she tried to dissemble. "Mercy's sake, I don't know what you're talking about." "Yes, you do." Junin looked around quickly, but the two women had this corner of that strange afternoon to themselves. "Mr. Gaunt." Myrtle nodded and felt her cheeks heat in a fierce, unaccustomed blush. "What did you get?" June asked.
"A doll. What did you get?"
"A vase. The most beautiful cloisonné vase you ever saw."
"What did you do?"
Smiling slyly, June countered. "What did you do?"
"Never mind."
Myrtle looked back toward the Daughters of Isabella Hall and then sniffed. "It doesn't matter anyway. They're only Catholics."
"That's right."
June, who was a lapsed Catholic herself, replied. Then she had gone to her car. Myrtle had not asked for a ride, and June Gavinoe did not offer one. Myrtle had walked rapidly out of the parking lot. She had not looked up when June shot by her in her white Saturn. All Myrtle had wanted was to go home, take a nap while she cuddled her lovely doll, and forget what she had done. That, she was now discovering, was not going to be as easy as she had hoped.
Wonk!
Buster planted his palm on the horn and held it down. The blare rang and blasted in his ears. Where in hell's name was that bitch? At last, the door between the garage and the kitchen opened. Myrtle poked her head through. Her eyes were large and frightened.
"Well, finally," Buster said, letting go of the horn. "I thought you died on the John."
"Danforth? What's wrong?"
"Nothing. Things are better than they've been for 2 years. I just need a little help, that's all."
Myrtle didn't move.
"Woman, get your fat ass over here."
She didn't want to go. He scared her. But the habit was old and deep and hard to break. She came around to where he stood in the wedge of space behind the car's open door. She walked slowly, her slippers scuffing the concrete floor in a way that made Buster grind his teeth together. She saw the handcuffs and her eyes widened.
"Danforth, what happened?"
"Nothing I can't handle. Pass me that hacksaw, Mert. The one on the wall. No, on second thought, never mind the hacksaw right now. Give me the big screwdriver instead, and that hammer." She started to draw away from him, her hands going up to her chest and joining there in an anxious knot. Quick as a snake, moving before she could back out of his reach, Buster shot his free hand through the open window and seized her by the hair.
Ow!
She screamed, grabbing futilely at his fist. Danforth! Ow! Ow! Buster dragged her toward him, his face clenched in a horrible grimace. Two large veins pulsed in his forehead. He felt her hand beating against his fist no more than he would have felt a bird's wing.
Get what I tell you! He cried and pulled her head forward.
He thumped it against the top of the open door once, twice, three times. Were you born foolish or did you just grow that way? Get it! Get it! Get it!
Danforth, you're hurting me!
Right! He screamed back and thumped her head once more against the top of the Cadillac's open door, much harder this time. The skin of her forehead split, and thin blood began to flow down the left side of her face.
Are you going to mind me, woman?
Yes! Yes! Yes!
Good. He relaxed his grip on her hair. Now give me the big screwdriver and the hammer, and don't try any funny business either. She waved her right arm toward the wall.
I can't reach.
He leaned forward, extending his own reach a little, and allowing her to take a step toward the wall where the tools hung. He kept his fingers wrapped firmly in her hair as she groped. Dime-sized drops of blood splattered on and between her slippers. Her hand closed on one of the tools, and Danforth shook her head briskly, the way a terrier might shake a dead rat.
Not that, Dumbo, he said. That's a drill. Did I ask for a drill? Huh?
But Danforth, ow! I can't see.
I suppose you'd like me to let you go. Then you could run into the house and call them, couldn't you?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, no. You're such an innocent little lamb. It was just an accident that you got me out of the way on Sunday so that fucking deputy could put them lying stickers up all over the house. Is that what you expect me to believe?
She looked back at him through the tangles of her hair. Blood had formed fine beads in her eyelashes.
But Danforth, you asked me out on Sunday. You said...
He jerked hard on her hair. Myrtle screamed. Just get what I asked for. We can discuss this later. She fell along the wall again, head down, hair, except for Buster's fistful, hanging in her face. Her groping fingers touched the big screwdriver.
That's one, he said. Let's try for two. What do you say?
She fumbled some more, and at last her fluttering fingers happened on the perforated rubber sleeve which covered the handle of the craftsman hammer.
Good. Now give 'em to me.
She pulled the hammer off its pegs, and Buster reeled her in. He let go of her hair, ready to snatch a fresh handful if she showed any sign of bolting. Myrtle didn't. She was cowed. She only wanted to be allowed back upstairs, where she would cuddle her beautiful doll to her and go to sleep. She felt like sleeping forever. He took the tools from her unresisting hands. He placed the tip of the screwdriver against the door handle, then whacked the top of the screwdriver several times with the hammer. On the fourth blow, the door handle snapped off. Buster slipped the loop of the cuff out of it, then dropped both the handle and the screwdriver to the concrete floor. He went first to the button which closed the garage door. Then, as it rattled noisily down on its tracks, he advanced on Myrtle with the hammer in his hand.
Did you sleep with him, Myrtle?
He asked softly.
What?
She looked at him with dull, apathetic eyes. Buster began to whack the hammerhead into the palm of his hand. It made a soft, fleshy sound.
Thuck, thuck, thuck.
Did you sleep with him after the two of you put up those goddamn pink slips all over the house? She looked at him dully, not understanding, and Buster himself had forgotten that she had been with him at Maurice when Ridgwick broke in and did his thing.
Buster, what are you talking about?
He stopped, his eyes widening.
What did you call me?
The apathy left her eyes. She began to retreat from him, hunching her shoulders protectively. Behind them, the garage door came to rest. Now the only sounds in the garage were their scuffling feet and the soft clink of the handcuff chain as it swung back and forth.
I'm sorry,
she whispered.
I'm sorry, Danforth.
Then she turned and ran for the kitchen door. He caught her three steps from it, once again using her hair to draw her to him.
What did you call me?
He screamed and raised the hammer. Her eyes turned to follow its ascent.
Danforth, no, please!
What did you call me? What did you call me?
He screamed it over and over again, and each time he asked the question, he punctuated it with that soft, fleshy sound. Thuck! 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 Ace drove into the Camber dooryard at 5 o'clock. He stuffed the treasure map into his back pocket, then opened the trunk. He got the pick and shovel, which Mr. God had thoughtfully provided, and then walked over to the leaning, overgrown porch, which ran along one side of the house. He took the map out of his back pocket and sat on the steps to examine it. The short-term effects of the coke had worn off, but his heart was still thudding briskly along in his chest. Treasure hunting, he had discovered, was also a stimulant. He looked around for a moment at the weedy yard, the sagging barn, the clusters of blindly staring sunflowers. It's not much, but I think this is it just the same, he thought. The place where I put the Corson brothers behind me forever and get rich in the bargain. It's here. Some of it, or all of it. Right here. I can feel it. But it was more than a feeling. He could hear it, singing softly to him, singing from beneath the ground. Not just tens of thousands, but hundreds of thousands. Perhaps as much as a million.
$1 million,
Ace whispered in a hushed, choked voice and bent over the map. 5 minutes later, he was hunting along the west side of the Camber house. Most of the way down toward the back, almost obscured in tall weeds, he found what he was looking for, a large, flat stone. He picked it up, threw it aside, and began to dig frantically. Less than 2 minutes later, there was a muffled clunk as the blade struck rusty metal. Ace fell on his knees, rooted in the dirt like a dog hunting a buried bone, and a minute later he unearthed the Sherwin-Williams paint can which had been buried here. Most dedicated cocaine users are also dedicated nail biters, and Ace was no exception. He had no fingernails to pry with, and he couldn't get the lid off. The paint around the rim had dried to an obstinate glue. With a grunt of frustration and rage, Ace pulled out his pocket knife, got the blade under the can's rim, and levered the cover off. He peered in eagerly. Bills! Sheafs and sheafs of bills! With a cry, he seized them, pulled them out, and saw that his eagerness had deceived him. It was only more trading stamps, red ball stamps this time, a kind which had been redeemable only south of the Mason-Dixon line, and there only until 1964, when the company had gone out of business. Shit fire and save matches, Ace cried. He threw the stamps aside. They unfolded and began to tumble away in the light, hot breeze that had sprung up. Some of them caught and fluttered from the weeds like dusty banners. Cunt! Bastard! Son of a whore! He rooted in the can, even turned it over to see if there was anything taped to the bottom, and found nothing. He threw it away, stared at it for a moment, then rushed over and booted it like a soccer ball. He felt in his pocket for the map again. There was one panicky second when he was afraid it wasn't there, that he had lost it somehow, but he had only pushed it all the way down to the bottom in his eagerness to get cracking. He yanked it out and looked at it. The other cross was out behind the barn, and suddenly a wonderful idea came into Ace's mind, lighting up the angry darkness in there like a Roman candle on the 4th of July. The can he had just dug up was a blind. Pop might have thought someone would tumble to the fact that he had marked his various stashes with flat rocks. Thus, he had practiced a little of the old bait-and-switch out here at the Camber place, just to be safe. A hunter who found one useless treasure trove would never guess that there was another stash, right here on this same property, but in a more out-of-the-way place. Unless they had a map, Ace whispered, like I do. He grabbed the pick and shovel and raced for the barn, eyes wide, sweaty, graying hair matted to the sides of his head. He saw the old airflow trailer and ran toward it. He was almost there when his foot struck something and he fell sprawling to the ground. He was up in a moment, looking around. He saw what he had stumbled over at once. It was a shovel, one with fresh dirt on the blade. A bad feeling began to creep over Ace, a very bad feeling indeed. It began in his belly, then spread upward to his chest and down to his balls. His lips peeled back from his teeth, very slowly, in an ugly snarl. He got to his feet and saw the rock marker lying nearby, dirt side up. It had been thrown aside. Someone had been here first, and not long ago, from the look. Someone had beaten him to the treasure.
No,
he whispered. The word fell from his snarling mouth like a drop of tainted blood or infected saliva.
No!
Not far from the shovel and the uprooted rock, Ace saw a pile of loose dirt which had been scraped indifferently back into a hole. Ignoring both his own tools and the shovel which the thief had left behind, Ace fell on his knees again and began pawing dirt out of the hole. In no time at all, he had found the Crisco can. He brought it out and pried off the lid. There was nothing inside but a white envelope. Ace took it out and tore it open. Two things fluttered out, a sheet of folded paper and a smaller envelope. Ace ignored the second envelope for the time being and unfolded the paper. It was a typed note. His mouth dropped open as he read his own name at the top of the sheet. Dear Ace, I can't be sure you'll find this, but there's no law against hoping. Sending you to Shawshank was fun, but this has been even better. I wish I could see your face when you finish reading this. Not long after I sent you up, I went to see Pop. I saw him pretty often, once a month, in fact. We had an arrangement. He gave me $100 a month, and I let him go on making his illegal loans, all very civilized. Halfway through this particular meeting, he excused himself to use the toilet. Something he et, he said. Ha ha! I took the opportunity to peek in his desk, which he had left unlocked. Such carelessness was not like him, but I think he was afraid he might load his pants if he didn't go to visit his Uncle John right away. Ha! I only found one item of interest, but that one was a corker. It looked like a map. There were lots of crosses on it, but one of the crosses, the one marking this spot, was marked in red. I put the map back before Pop returned. He never knew I looked at it. I came out here right after he died and dug up this Crisco can. There was better than $200,000 in it, Ace. Don't worry, though. I decided to share and share alike, and I'm going to leave you exactly what you deserve. Welcome back to town, Ace Hole. Yours sincerely, Alan Pangborn, Castle County Sheriff. P.S. A word to the wise, Ace. Now that you know, take your lumps and forget the whole thing. You know the old saying, finders keepers. If you ever try to brace me about your uncle's money, I will tear you a new asshole and stuff your head into it. Trust me on this. A.P. Ace let the sheet of paper slide from his numb fingers and opened the second envelope. A single $1 bill fell out of it. I decided to share and share alike, and am going to leave you exactly what you deserve.
You crab-infested bastard! Ace whispered, and picked up the dollar bill with shaking fingers.
Welcome back to town, Ace Hole.
You son of a whore!
Ace screamed so loudly that he felt something in his throat strain and almost rupture. The echo came back dimly. Whore, whore, whore. He began to tear the dollar up, then forced his fingers to relax. Uh-uh. No way, Jose. He was going to save this. The son of a bitch had wanted Pop's money, had he? He had stolen what rightfully belonged to Pop's last living relative, had he? Well, all right. Good. Fine. But he should have all of it. And Ace intended to see that the sheriff had just that. So after he removed Pussbag's testicles with his pocket knife, he intended to stuff this dollar bill into the bloody hole where they had been. You want the money, Daddy-O? Ace asked in a soft, musing voice. Okay. That's okay. No problem. No fucking problem. He got to his feet and began walking back toward the car in a stiff, staggering version of his usual hood strut. By the time he got there, he was almost running. By 5:45, a weird twilight had begun to creep over Castle Rock. Thunderheads were stacking up on the southern horizon. Low, distant boomings muttered over the woods and fields from that direction. The clouds were moving toward town, growing as they came. The streetlights, governed by a master photoelectric cell, came on a full half hour earlier than they usually did at that time of the year. Lower Main Street was a crowded confusion. It had been overrun by state police vehicles and TV news vans. Radio calls crackled and entwined in the hot, still air. TV technicians paid out cable and yelled at the people, kids mostly, who tripped over the loose lengths of it before they could anchor it temporarily to the pavement with duct tape. Photographers from four daily papers stood outside the barricades in front of the municipal building and took stills which would appear on front pages the following day. A few locals, surprisingly few if anyone had bothered to notice such things, rubbernecked. A TV correspondent stood in the glare of a high-intensity lamp and taped his report with the municipal building in the background. A senseless wave of violence swished through Castle Rock this afternoon, he began, and then stopped. Swished? He asked himself disgustedly. Shit, let's take it again from the top. To his left, a TV dude from another station was watching his crew prepare for what would be a live feed in less than 20 minutes. More of the onlookers had been drawn to the familiar faces of the TV correspondents than to the barricades, where there had been nothing to see since two orderlies from medical assistance had brought out the unfortunate Lester Pratt in a black plastic bag, loaded him into the back of their ambulance, and driven away. Upper Main, away from the blue strobes of the state police cruisers and the bright pools of the TV lights, was almost entirely deserted. Almost. Every now and then, a car or a pickup truck would park in one of the slant spaces in front of Needful Things. Every now and then, a pedestrian would saunter up to the new shop, where the display lights were off and the shade was pulled down on the door under the canopy. Every now and then, one of the rubberneckers on Lower Main would break away from the shifting knot of onlookers and walk up the street, past the vacant lot where the Emporium Galorium had once stood, past You So-and-So, closed and dark, to the new store. No one noticed this trickle of visitors. Not the police, not the camera crews, not the correspondents, not the majority of the bystanders. They were looking at the scene of the crime, and their backs were turned to the place where, less than 300 yards away, the crime was still going on. If some disinterested observer had been keeping an eye on Needful Things, he or she would have quickly detected a pattern. The visitors approached. The visitor saw the sign in the window which read, "Closed until further notice." The visitors stepped back, identical expressions of frustration and distress on their faces. They looked like hurting junkies who had discovered the pusher man wasn't where he'd promised to be. "What do I do now?" their faces said. Most stepped forward to read the sign again, as if a second, closer scrutiny would somehow change the message. A few got into their cars and left, or wandered down toward the municipal building to stare at the free show for a while, looking dazed and vaguely disappointed. On the faces of most, however, an expression of sudden comprehension dawned. They had the look of people suddenly understanding some basic concept, like how to diagram simple sentences or reduce a pair of fractions to their lowest common denominator. These people walked around the corner to the service alley, which ran behind the business buildings on Main Street, the alley where Ace had parked the Tucker Talisman the night before. 40 feet down, an oblong of yellow light fell out of an open door and across the patched concrete. This light grew slowly brighter as day slipped into evening. A shadow lay in the center of the oblong, like a silhouette cut from mourner's crepe. The shadow belonged, of course, to Leland Gaunt. He had placed a table in the doorway. On it was a Roy Tan cigar box. He put the money which his customers tendered into this box and made change from it. These patrons approached hesitantly, even fearfully in some cases, but all of them had one thing in common. They were angry people with heavy grudges to tote. A few, not many, turned away before they reached Mr. Gaunt's makeshift counter. Some went running, with the wide eyes of men and women who have glimpsed a frightful fiend licking its chops in the shadows. Most, however, stayed to do business, and as Mr. Gaunt bantered with them, treating this odd backdoor commerce as an amusing diversion at the end of a long day, they relaxed. Mr. Gaunt had enjoyed his shop, but he never felt so comfortable behind plate glass and under a roof as he did here, on the edge of the air, with the first breezes of the coming storm stirring his hair. The shop, with its clever display lights on ceiling-mounted tracks, was all right. But this was better. This was always better. He had begun business many years ago as a wandering peddler on the blind face of a distant land, a peddler who carried his wares on his back, a peddler who usually came at the fall of darkness and was always gone the next morning, leaving bloodshed, horror, and unhappiness behind him. Years later, in Europe, as the plague raged and the dead carts rolled, he had gone from town to town and country to country in a wagon drawn by a slat, thin white horse with terrible burning eyes and a tongue as black as a killer's heart. He had sold his wares from the back of the wagon and was gone before his customers, who paid with small, ragged coins, or even in barter, could discover what they had really bought. Times changed, methods changed, faces too. But when the faces were needful, they were always the same, the faces of sheep who have lost their shepherd. And it was with this sort of commerce that he felt most at home, most like that wandering peddler of old, standing not behind a fancy counter with a suite of cash register nearby, but behind a plain wooden table, making change out of a cigar box and selling them the same item over and over and over again. The goods which had so attracted the residents of Castle Rock, the black pearls, the holy relics, the carnival glass, the pipes, the old comic books, the baseball cards, the antique kaleidoscopes, were all gone. Mr. Gaunt had gotten down to his real business, and at the end of things, the real business was always the same. The ultimate item had changed with the years, just like everything else, but such changes were surface things, frosting of different flavors on the same dark and bitter cake. At the end, Mr. Gaunt always sold them weapons, and they always bought. "Why, thank you, Mr. Warburton," Mr. Gaunt said, taking a $5 bill from the black janitor. He handed him back a single and one of the automatic pistols Ace had brought from Boston. "Thank you, Miss Milliken." He took 10 and gave back 8. He charged them what they could afford, not a penny more or a penny less. Each according to his means was Mr. Gaunt's motto, and never mind each according to his needs, because they were all needful things, and he had come here to fill their emptiness and end their aches. "Good to see you, Mr. Emerson." Oh, it was always good, so very good, to be doing business in the old way again, and business had never been better. Alan Pangborn wasn't in Castle Rock. While the reporters and the state police gathered at one end of Main Street, and Leland Gaunt conducted his going-out-of-business sale halfway up the hill, Alan was sitting in the nurses' station of the Bloomer Wing in Northern Cumberland Hospital in Bridgeton. The Bloomer Wing was small, only 14 patient rooms, but what it lacked in size, it made up for in color. The walls of the inpatient rooms were painted in bright primary shades. A mobile hung from the ceiling in the nurse's station, the birds depending from it swinging and dipping gracefully around a central spindle. Alan was sitting in front of a huge mural which depicted a medley of Mother Goose rhymes. One section of the mural showed a man leaning across a table, holding something out to a small boy, obviously a hick, who looked both frightened and fascinated. Something about this particular image had struck Alan, and a snatch of childhood rhyme rose like a whisper in his mind. "Simple Simon met a pieman going to the fair. Simple Simon," said the pieman, "come and taste my wares." A ripple of goose flesh had broken out on Alan's arms, tiny bumps like beads of cold sweat. He couldn't say why, and that seemed perfectly normal. Never in his entire life had he felt as shaken, as scared, as deeply confused as he did right now. Something totally beyond his ability to understand was happening in Castle Rock. It had become clearly apparent only late this afternoon, when everything had seemed to blow sky high at once, but it had begun days, maybe even a week, ago. He didn't know what it was, but he knew that Nettie Cobb and Wilma Jurczyk had only been the first outward signs. And he was terribly afraid that things were still progressing while he sat here with Simple Simon and the pieman. A nurse, Miss Hendry, according to the small nameplate on her breast, walked up the corridor on faintly squeaking crepe soles, weaving her way gracefully among the toys which littered the hall. When Alan came in, half a dozen kids, some with limbs in casts or slings, some with the partial baldness he associated with chemotherapy treatments, had been playing in the hall, trading blocks and trucks, shouting amiably to each other. Now it was the supper hour, and they had gone either down to the cafeteria or back to their rooms. "How is he?" Alan asked Miss Hendry. "No change." She looked at Alan with a calm expression which contained an element of hostility. "Sleeping. He should be sleeping. He has had a great shock. But what do you hear from his parents?" "We called the father's place of employment in South Paris. He had an installation job over in New Hampshire this afternoon. He's left for home, I understand, and will be informed when he arrives. He should get here around 9, I would think, but of course it's impossible to tell." "What about the mother?" "I don't know," Miss Hendry said. The hostility was more apparent now, but it was no longer aimed at Alan. "I didn't make that call. All I know is what I see. She's not here. This little boy saw his brother commit suicide with a rifle, and although it happened at home, the mother is not here yet. You'll have to excuse me now. I have to fill the med cart."
"Of course," Alan muttered.
He watched her as she started away, then rose from his chair. "Miss Hendry?" She turned to him. Her eyes were still calm, but her raised brows expressed annoyance. "Miss Hendry, I really do need to talk with Sean Rusk. I think I need to talk to him very badly." "Oh?" Her voice was cool. "Something..." Alan suddenly thought of Polly, and his voice cracked. He cleared his throat and pushed on. "Something is going on in my town. The suicide of Brian Rusk is only part of it, I believe. And I also believe that Sean Rusk may have the key to the rest of it. Sheriff Pangborn, Sean Rusk is only 7 years old, and if he does know something, why aren't there other policemen here?" "Other policemen," he thought. "What she means are qualified policemen. Policemen who don't interview 11-year-old boys on the street and then send them home to commit suicide in the garage." "Because they've got their hands full," Alan said, "and because they don't know the town the way that I do." "I see." She turned to go again. "Miss Hendry." "Sheriff, I'm short-handed this evening and very bi-" Brian Rusk wasn't the only Castle Rock fatality today. There were at least three others. Another man, the owner of the local tavern, has been taken to the hospital in Norway with gunshot trauma. He may live, but it's going to be touch and go with him for the next 36 hours or so, and I have a hunch the killing isn't done. He had finally succeeded in capturing all of her attention. "You believe Sean Rusk knows something about this?" "He may know why his brother killed himself. If he does, that may open up the rest of it. So if he wakes up, will you tell me?" She hesitated, then said, "That depends on his mental state when he does, Sheriff. I'm not going to allow you to make a hysterical little boy's condition worse, no matter what is going on in your town." "I understand." "Do you? Good." She gave him a look which said, "Just sit there and don't make trouble for me then," and went back behind the high desk. She sat down, and he could hear her putting bottles and boxes on the med cart. Alan got up, went to the payphone in the hall, and dialed Polly's number again. And once again it simply rang on and on. He dialed "you so-and-so," got the answering machine, and racked the phone. He went back to his chair, sat in it, and stared at the Mother Goose mural some more. "You forgot to ask me one question, Miss Hendry," Alan thought. "You forgot to ask me why I'm here if there's so much going on in the seat of the county I was elected to preserve and protect. You forgot to ask me why I'm not leading the investigation while some less essential officer, old Seat Thomas, for instance, sits here waiting for Sean Rusk to wake up. You forgot to ask those things, Miss Hendry, and I know a secret. I'm glad you forgot. That's the secret." The reason was as simple as it was humiliating. Except in Portland and Bangor, murder belonged not to the sheriff's office, but to the state police. Henry Payton had winked at that in the wake of Nettie and Wilma's duel, but he was not winking anymore. He couldn't afford to. Representatives of every Southern Maine newspaper and TV station were either in Castle Rock right now or on their way. They would be joined by their colleagues from all over the state before very much longer. And if this really was not over, as Alan suspected, they would shortly be joined by more media people from points south. That was the simple reality of the situation, but it didn't change the way Alan felt. He felt like a pitcher who can't get the job done and is sent to the showers by the coach. It was an indescribably shitty way to feel. He sat in front of Simple Simon and once again began to add up the score. Lester Pratt, dead. He had come to the sheriff's office in a jealous frenzy and had attacked John LaPointe. It was over his girl, apparently, although John had told Alan before the ambulance came that he had not dated Sally Ratcliffe in over a year.
I only saw her to speak to once in a while on a street, and even then she cut me dead most of the time. She decided I'm one of the hellbound. He had touched his broken nose and winced. Right now, I feel hellbound. John was now hospitalized in Norway with a broken nose, a fractured jaw, and possible internal injuries. Sheila Brigham was also in the hospital. Shock. Hugh Priest and Billy Tupper were both dead. That news had come in just as Sheila was beginning to fall apart. The call came from a beer delivery man who'd had the sense to call medical assistance before calling the sheriff. The man had been almost as hysterical as Sheila Brigham, and Alan hadn't blamed him. By then, he had been feeling pretty hysterical himself. Henry Beaufort, in critical condition as a result of multiple gunshot wounds. Norris Ridgwick, missing, and that somehow hurt the most. Alan had looked around for him after receiving the delivery man's call, but Norris was just gone. Alan had assumed at the time that he must have gone outside to formally arrest Danforth and would return with the head selectman in tow, but events shortly proved that no one had arrested Keaton. Alan supposed the Stateys would arrest him if they ran across him while they pursued other lines of investigation, but otherwise, no. They had more important things to do. In the meantime, Norris was just gone. Wherever he was, he'd gotten there on foot. When Alan left town, Norris's VW had still been lying on its side in the middle of Lower Main Street. The witnesses said Buster had crawled into his Cadillac through the window and simply driven away. The only person who had tried to stop him had paid a steep price. Scott Garson was hospitalized here at Northern Cumberland with a broken jaw, broken cheekbone, broken wrist, and 3 broken fingers. It could have been worse. The bystanders claimed Buster had actively tried to run the man down as he lay in the street. Lenny Partridge, broken collarbone, 2 broken ribs, was also here someplace. Andy Clutterbuck had weighed in with news of this fresh disaster while Alan was still trying to comprehend the fact that the town's head selectman was now a fugitive from justice handcuffed to a big red Cadillac. Hugh Priest had apparently stopped Lenny, tossed him across the road, and driven away in the old man's car. Alan supposed they would find Lenny's car in the parking lot of the Mellow Tiger, since Hugh had bitten the dust there. And, of course, there was Brian Rusk, who had eaten a bullet at the ripe old age of 11. Clut had barely begun to tell his tale when the phone rang again. Sheila was gone by then, and Alan had picked up on the voice of a screaming, hysterical little boy, Sean Rusk, who had dialed the number on the bright orange sticker beside the kitchen telephone. All in all, medical assistance ambulances and rescue service units from 4 different towns had made afternoon stops in Castle Rock. Now, sitting with his back to Simple Simon in the pieman, watching the plastic birds as they swung and dipped around their spindle, Alan turned once more to Hugh and Lenny Partridge. Their confrontation was hardly the biggest to take place in Castle Rock today, but it was one of the oddest, and Alan sensed that a key to this business might be hidden in its very oddity. Why in God's name didn't Hugh take his own car if he had a hard-on for Henry Beaufort? Alan had asked Clut, running his hands through hair which was already wildly disarranged. Why bother with Lenny's old piece of shit? Because Hugh's Buick was standing on 4 flats. Looked like somebody ripped the shit out of them with a knife. Clut had shrugged, looking uneasily at the shambles the sheriff's office had become. Maybe he thought Henry Beaufort did it. Yes, Alan thought now, maybe so. It was crazy, but was it any crazier than Wilma Jurczyk thinking Nettie Cobb had first splattered mud on her sheets and then thrown rocks through the windows of her house? Any crazier than Nettie thinking Wilma had killed her dog? Before he had a chance to question Clut any further, Henry Payton had come in and told Alan, as kindly as he could, that he was taking the case. Alan nodded. There's one thing you need to find out, Henry, as soon as you can. What's that, Alan? Henry had asked, but Alan saw, with a sinking feeling, that Henry was listening to him with only half an ear. His old friend, the first real friend Alan had made in the wider law enforcement community after winning the job as sheriff, and a very valuable friend he had turned out to be, was already concentrating on other things. How he would deploy his forces, given the widespread of the incidents, was probably chief among them. You need to find out if Henry Beaufort was as angry at Hugh Priest as Hugh apparently was with him. You can't ask him now. I understand he's unconscious, but when he wakes up... Will do, Henry said and clapped Alan on the shoulder. Will do. Then, raising his voice, Brooks, Morrison, over here. Alan watched him move off and thought of going after him, of grabbing him and making him listen.
He didn't do it because Henry and Hugh and Lester and John, even Wilma and Nettie, were beginning to lose any feeling of real importance to him. The dead were dead. The wounded were being looked after. The crimes had been committed. Except Alan had a terrible sneaking suspicion that the real crime was still going on. When Henry had walked away to brief his men, Alan had called Clut over once again. The deputy came with his hands stuffed into his pockets and a morose look on his face. "We've been replaced, Alan," he said, "taken right out of the picture. God damn!" "Not entirely," Alan said, hoping he sounded as if he really believed this. "You're going to be my liaison here, Clut." "Where are you going?" "To the Rusk house." But when he got there, both Brian and Sean Rusk were gone. The ambulance, which was taking care of the unfortunate Scott Garson, had swung by to pick up Sean. They were on their way to Northern Cumberland Hospital. Harry Samuels' second hearse, an old converted Lincoln, had gotten Brian Rusk and would take him to Oxford, pending autopsy. Harry's better hearse, the one he referred to as the company car, had already left for the same place with Hugh and Billy Tupper. Alan thought, the bodies will be stacked in that tiny morgue over there like cordwood. It was when he got to the Rusk home that Alan realized, in his gut as well as in his head, how completely he had been taken out of the play. Two of Henry's CID men were there ahead of him, and they made it clear that Alan could hang around only as long as he didn't try to stick in an oar and help them row. He had stood in the kitchen doorway for a moment, watching them, feeling about as useful as a third wheel on a motor scooter. Cora Rusk's responses were slow, almost doped. Alan thought it might be shock, or perhaps the ambulance attendants who were transporting her remaining son to the hospital had given her some prescription mercy before they left. She reminded him eerily of the way Norris had looked as he had crawled from the window of his overturned VW. Whether it was because of a tranquilizer or just shock, the detectives weren't getting much value from her. She wasn't quite weeping, but she was clearly unable to concentrate on their questions enough to make helpful responses. She didn't know anything, she told them. She had been upstairs, taking a nap. Poor Brian, she kept saying. Poor, poor Brian. But she expressed this sentiment in a drone which Alan found creepy, and she kept toying with a pair of old sunglasses which lay beside her on the kitchen table. One of the bows had been mended with adhesive tape, and one of the lenses was cracked. Alan had left in disgust and come here to the hospital. Now he got up and went to the pay telephone down the hall in the main lobby. He tried Polly again, got no answer, and then dialed the sheriff's office. The voice which answered growled, "State Police!" and Alan felt a childish surge of jealousy. He identified himself and asked for Clut. After a wait of almost 5 minutes, Clut came on the line. "Sorry, Alan. They just let the phone lay there on the desk. Lucky I came over to check or you'd still be waiting. Darned old stateies don't care one bit about us." "Don't worry about it, Clut. Has anyone collared Keaton yet?" "Well, I don't know how to tell you this, Alan, but..." Alan felt a sinking in the pit of his stomach and closed his eyes. He had been right. It wasn't over. "Just tell me," he said. "Never mind the protocol." "Buster, Danforth, I mean, drove home and used a screwdriver to knock the door handle off his Cadillac. You know, where he was cuffed." "I know," Alan agreed. His eyes were still shut. "Well... he killed his wife, Alan, with a hammer. It wasn't a state cop that found her, because the stateies weren't much interested in Buster up to 20 minutes ago. It was Seat Thomas. He drove by Buster's house to double-check. He reported in what he found and got back here not 5 minutes ago. He's having chest pains, he says, and I'm not surprised. He told me that Buster took her face about right off, said there's guts and hair every place. There's a platoon or so of Peyton's blue jackets up there on the view now. I put Seat in your office. Figured he'd better sit down before he fell down." "Jesus Christ, Clut. Take him over to Ray Van Allen, fast. He's 62 and been smoking Camels all his damn life." "Ray went to Oxford, Alan. He's trying to help the doctors patch up Henry Beaufort." "His PA, then. What's his name?" "Frankel. Everett Frankel." "Not around. I tried both the office and his house." "Well, what's his wife say?" "Ev's a bachelor, Alan." "Oh, Christ." Someone had scrawled a bit of graffiti over the telephone. "Don't worry, be happy," it said. Alan considered this sourly. "I can take him to the hospital myself," Clut offered. "I need you right where you are," Alan said. "Have the reporters and TV people shown up?" "Yeah, the place is crawling with them." "Well, check on Seat as soon as we're done here. If he doesn't feel any better, here's what you do. Go out front, grab a reporter who looks halfway bright to you, deputize him, and have him drive Seat over here to Northern Cumberland. Okay. Clut hesitated, then burst out. I wanted to go over to the Keaton place, but the state police... They won't let me onto the crime scene. How do you like that, Alan? Those bastards won't let a county deputy sheriff onto the crime scene. I know how you feel. I don't like it much myself, but they're doing their job. Can you see Seat from where you are, Clut? Yeah. Well, is he alive? He's sitting behind your desk, smoking a cigarette and looking at this month's rural law enforcement. Right, Alan said. He felt like laughing or crying or doing both at the same time. That figures. Has Polly Chalmers called, Clut? No. Wait a minute. Here's the log. I thought it was gone. She did call, Alan, just before 3:30. Alan grimaced. I know about that one. Anything later? Not that I can see here, but that doesn't mean much. With Sheila gone and these darned old state bears clumping around, who can tell for sure? Thanks, Clut. Is there anything else I should know? Yeah, a couple of things. Shoot. They've got the gun Hugh used to shoot Henry, but David Friedman from State Police Ballistics says he doesn't know what it is. An automatic pistol of some kind, but the guy said he's never seen one quite like it. Are you sure it was David Friedman? Alan asked. Friedman, yeah, that was the guy's name. He must know. Dave Friedman's a walking shooter's Bible. Yeah, he doesn't, though. I stood right there while he was talking to your pal Peyton. He said it's a little like a German Mauser, but it lacked the normal markings and the slide was different. I think they sent it to Augusta with about a ton of other evidence. What else? They found an anonymous note in Henry Beaufort's yard, Clut said. It was crumpled into a ball beside his car. You know that classic T-bird of his? It was vandalized, too, just like Hugh's. Alan felt as if a large, soft hand had just whacked him across the face. What did the note say, Clut? Just a minute. He heard a faint, quick, quick sound as Clut paged through his notebook. Here it is. Don't you ever cut me off and then keep my car keys, you damn frog. Frog? That's what it says. Clut giggled nervously. The word ever and the word frog have got lines drawn under them. And you say the car was vandalized? That's right. Tires slashed, just like Hugh's, and a big long scratch down the passenger side. Ouch. Okay, Alan said. Here's something else for you to do. Go to the barber shop and then to the billiard parlor if you need to. Find out who it was Henry cut off, this week or last. But the state police... Fuck the state police, Alan said feelingly. It's our town. We know who to ask and where to find them. Do you want to tell me you can't lay hands on someone who'll know this story in just about 5 minutes? Of course not, Clut said. I saw Charlie Fortin when I came back from Castle Hill, noodling with a bunch of guys in front of the Western Auto. If Henry was bumping heads with somebody, Charlie will know who. Hell, the Tiger's Charlie's home away from home. Yes, but were the state police questioning him? Well, no, no. So you question him. But I think we both already know the answer, don't we? Hugh Priest, Clut said. It has the unmistakable clang of a ringer to me, Alan said. He thought, this is maybe not so different from Henry Peyton's first guess after all. Okay, Alan, I'll get on it. And call me back the minute you know for sure, the second. He gave Clut the number, then made him recite it back so he could be sure Clut had copied it down correctly. I will, Clut said, and then burst out furiously. What's going on, Alan? God damn it, what's going on around here? I don't know. Alan felt very old, very tired, and angry. No longer angry at Peyton for shunning him off the case, but angry at whoever was responsible for these gruesome fireworks. And he felt more and more sure that when they got to the bottom of it, they would discover that a single agency had been at work all along. Wilma and Nettie, Henry and Hugh, Lester and John. Someone had wired them together like packets of high explosive. I don't know, Clut, but we're going to find out. Toy. He wanted to call Clut back and ask him to check on her right away, before he did anything else, but couldn't. That would be very wrong when there might be other packets of explosives still waiting to explode in the rock. Yes, but Alan... Suppose Polly's one of them. That thought poked some buried association loose, but he was unable to grasp it before it floated away. Alan slowly hung up the telephone, cutting it off in mid-ring as he settled it into its cradle. Polly could stand it no longer. She rolled on her side, reached for the telephone, and it stilled in mid-ring. Good, she thought. But was it? She was lying on her bed, listening to the sound of approaching thunder. It was hot upstairs, as hot as the middle of July. But opening the windows was not an option, because she'd had Dave Phillips, one of the local handymen and caretakers, put on her storm windows and doors just the week before. So she had taken off the old jeans and shirt she had worn on her expedition to the country and folded them neatly over the chair by the door. Now she lay on the bed in her underwear, wanting a little nap before she got up and showered, but unable to go to sleep. Some of it was the sirens, but more of it was Alan, what Alan had done. She could not comprehend this grotesque betrayal of all she had believed and all she had trusted, but neither could she escape it. Her mind would turn to something else, those sirens, for instance, and how they sounded like the end of the world. And then, suddenly, it would be there again, how he had gone behind her back, how he had sneaked. It was like being poked by the splintery end of a board in some tender, secret place. "Oh, Alan, how could you?" she asked him, and herself, again. The voice which replied surprised her. It was Aunt Evie's voice, and beneath the dry lack of sentiment that had always been her way, Polly felt a disquieting, powerful anger. "If you had told him the truth in the first place, girl, he never would have had to." Polly sat up quickly. That was a disturbing voice, all right, and the most disturbing thing about it was the fact that it was her own voice. Aunt Evie was many years dead. This was her own subconscious, using Aunt Evie to express its anger, the way a shy ventriloquist might use his dummy to ask a pretty girl for a date and... "Stop it, girl. Didn't I once tell you this town is full of ghosts? Maybe it is me. Maybe it is." Polly uttered a whimpering, frightened cry, and then pressed her hand against her mouth. "Oh, maybe 'tisn't. In the end, who it is don't matter much, does it? The question is this, Tricia. Who sinned first? Who lied first? Who covered up first? Who cast the first stone?" "That's not fair," Polly shouted into the hot room, and then looked at her own frightened, wide-eyed reflection in the bedroom mirror. She waited for the voice of Aunt Evie to come back, and when it didn't, she slowly lay back down again. Perhaps she had sinned first, if omitting part of the truth and telling a few white lies was sinning. Perhaps she had covered up first. But did that give Alan the right to open an investigation on her, the way a law officer might open an investigation on a known felon? Did it give him the right to put her name on some interstate law enforcement wire, or send out a tracer on her, if that was what they called it, or... "Never mind, Polly." A voice, one she knew, whispered, "Stop tearing yourself apart over what was very proper behavior on your part. I mean, after all, you heard the guilt in his voice, didn't you?" "Yes," she muttered fiercely into the pillow. "That's right, I did. What about that, Aunt Evie?" There was no answer, only a queer, light tugging. "The question is this, Tricia," at her subconscious mind. As if she had forgotten something, left something out. "Would you like a sweet, Tricia?" of the equation. Polly rolled restlessly onto her side, and the Azka tumbled across the fullness of one breast. She heard something inside scratch delicately at the silver wall of its prison. "No," Polly thought, "it's just something shifting, something inert. This idea that there really is something alive in there, it's just your imagination." Scratch, scritch, scratch. The silver ball jiggled minutely between the white cotton cup of her bra and the coverlet of the bed. Scratchy, scritch, scratch. "That thing is alive, Tricia," Aunt Evie said. "That thing is alive, and you know it." "Don't be silly," Polly told her, tossing over to the other side. "How could there possibly be some creature in there? I suppose it might be able to breathe through all those tiny holes, but what in God's name would it eat?" "Maybe," Aunt Evie replied with a soft implacability, "it's eating you, Tricia." "Polly," she murmured. "My name is Polly." This time the tug at her subconscious mind was stronger, somehow alarming, and for a moment she was almost able to grasp it. Then the telephone began to ring again. She gasped and sat up, her face wearing a look of tired dismay. Pride and longing were at war there. "Talk to him, Tricia. What can it hurt? Better still, listen to him. You didn't do much of that before, did you?" I don't want to talk to him, not after what he did. But you still love him.
Yes, that was true. The only thing was, now she hated him as well. The voice of Aunt Evie rose once more, gusting angrily in her mind. Do you want to be a ghost all your life, Tricia? What's the matter with you, girl?
Polly reached out for the telephone in a mockery of decisiveness. Her hand, her limber, pain-free hand, faltered just short of the handset. Because maybe it wasn't Alan. Maybe it was Mr. Gaunt. Maybe Mr. Gaunt wanted to tell her that he wasn't finished with her yet, that she hadn't finished paying yet. She made another move toward the telephone. This time the tips of her fingers actually brushed the plastic casing, and then she drew back. Her hand clutched its partner, and they folded into a nervous ball on her belly. She was afraid of Aunt Evie's dead voice, of what she had done this afternoon, of what Mr. Gaunt, or Alan, might tell the town about her dead son, of what yonder confusion of sirens and racing cars might mean. But more than all of these things, she had discovered, she was afraid of Leland Gaunt himself. She felt as if someone had tied her to the clapper of a great iron bell, a bell which would simultaneously deafen her, drive her mad, and crush her to a pulp if it began to ring. The telephone fell quiet. Outside, another siren began to scream, and as it began to fade toward the tin bridge, the thunder rolled again, closer than ever now.
Take it off, the voice of Aunt Evie whispered. Take it off, honey. You can do it. His power is over need, not will. Take it off. Break his hold on you.
But she was looking at the telephone and remembering the night, was it less than a week ago, when she had reached for it and struck it with her fingers, knocking it to the floor. She remembered the pain which had clawed its way up her arm like a hungry rat with broken teeth. She couldn't go back to that. She just couldn't. Could she? Something nasty's going on in the rock tonight, Aunt Evie said. Do you want to wake up tomorrow and have to figure out how much of it was your nastiness? Is that really a score you want to add up, Tricia? You don't understand, she moaned. It wasn't on Alan, it was on Ace. Ace Merrill, and he deserves whatever he gets. The implacable voice of Aunt Evie returned. And so do you, honey. So do you. At 6:20 on that Tuesday evening, as the thunderheads neared and real dark began to overtake twilight, the state police officer who had replaced Sheila Brigham in dispatch came out into the sheriff's office bullpen. He skirted the large area, roughly diamond-shaped, which was marked with crime scene tape, and hurried over to where Henry Peyton stood. Peyton looked disheveled and unhappy. He had spent the previous 5 minutes with the ladies and gentlemen of the press, and he felt as he always did after one of these confrontations, as if he had been coated with honey and then forced to roll in a large pile of ant-infested hyena shit. His statement had not been as well prepared or as unassailably vague as he would have liked. The TV people had forced his hand. They wanted to do live updates during the 6 to 6:30 time slot when the local news was broadcast, felt they had to do live updates, and if he didn't throw them some kind of a bone, they were apt to crucify him at 11. They had almost crucified him anyway. He had come as close as he ever had in his entire career to admitting he didn't have a fucking clue. He had not left this impromptu press conference. He had escaped it. Peyton found himself wishing he had listened more closely to Alan. When he arrived, it had seemed that the job was essentially damage control. Now he wondered, because there had been another murder since he took the case, a woman named Myrtle Keaton. Her husband was still out there someplace, probably headed over the hills and far away by now, but just possibly still galloping gaily around this weird little town. A man who had offed his wife with a hammer. A prime psycho, in other words. The trouble was, he didn't know these people. Allen and his deputies did, but both Allen and Ridgwick were gone. LaPointe was in the hospital, probably hoping the doctors could get his nose on straight again. He looked around for Clutterbuck and was somehow not surprised to see that he had also melted away. You want it, Henry? He heard Allen say inside his head. Fine, take it. And as far as suspects go, why not try the phone book? Lieutenant Peyton? Lieutenant Peyton! It was the officer from dispatch.
What?
Henry growled. I've got Dr. Van Allen on the radio. He wants to talk to you.
About what?
He wouldn't say. He only told me he had to speak to you. Henry Peyton walked into the dispatcher's office feeling more and more like a kid riding a bike with no brakes down a steep hill with a drop-off on one side, a rock wall on the other, and a pack of hungry wolves with reporters' faces behind him. He picked up the mic. This is Peyton. Come back. Lieutenant Peyton, this is Dr. Van Allen, County Medical Examiner. The voice was hollow and distant, broken up occasionally by heavy bursts of static. That would be the approaching storm, Henry knew. More fun with Dick and Jane. Yes, I know who you are, Henry said. You took Mr. Beaufort to Oxford. How is he? Come back? He's crackle, crackle, buzz, snacker. You're breaking up, Dr. Van Allen, Henry said, speaking as patiently as he could. We've got what looks to be a really first-class electrical storm on the way here. Please say again, okay? Dead! Van Allen shouted through a break in the static. He died in the ambulance, but we do not believe it was gunshot trauma which killed him. Do you understand? We do not believe this patient died of gunshot trauma. His brain first underwent atypical edema and then ruptured. The most likely diagnosis is that some toxic substance, some extremely toxic substance, was introduced into his blood when he was shot. This same substance appears to have literally burst his heart open. Please acknowledge. Oh, Jesus, Henry Peyton thought. He pulled down his tie, unbuttoned his collar, and then pressed the transmit button again. I acknowledge your message, Dr. Van Allen, but I'll be damned if I understand it, Kay. The toxin was very likely on the bullets in the gun that shot him. The infection appears to spread slowly at first, then to pick up speed. We have two clear, fan-shaped areas of introduction here, the cheek wound and the chest wound. It's very important to... Crack, snackle, buzz it. Has it? 10-4? Say again, Dr. Van Allen. Henry wished to Christ the man had simply picked up the telephone. Please say again. Come back. Who has that gun? Van Allen shrieked. 10-4! David Friedman, ballistics. He's taken it to Augusta. K. Would he have unloaded it first? 10-4? Yes, that's standard practice. Come back. Was it a revolver or an automatic, Lieutenant Peyton? That's of prime importance right now. 10-4. An automatic. K. Would he have unloaded the clip? 10-4? He'd do that at Augusta. Peyton sat down heavily in the dispatcher's chair. Suddenly, he needed to take a heavy dump. 10-4. No, no, he mustn't. He must not do that. Do you copy? I copy, Henry said. I'll leave a message for him at the ballistics lab saying he's to leave the goddamn bullets in the goddamn clip until we get this latest goddamn snafu sorted the goddamn hell out. He felt a childish pleasure at the realization that this was going out on the air, and then he wondered how many of the reporters out front were monitoring him on their Bearcats. Listen, Dr. Van Allen, we've got no business talking about this on the radio, 10-4. Never mind the public relations aspect, Van Allen came back harshly. We're talking about a man's life here, Lieutenant Peyton. I tried to get you on the telephone and couldn't get through. Tell your man Friedman to examine his hands carefully for scratches, small nicks, even hangnails. If he has the smallest break in the skin of his hands, he's to go to the nearest hospital immediately. I have no way of knowing if the crap we're dealing with was on the casing of the ammunition clip as well as on the bullets themselves. And it isn't the kind of thing he wants to take the slightest chance with. This stuff is deadly. 10-4? I acknowledge, Henry heard himself say. He found himself wishing he were anywhere but here. But since he was here, he wished that Alan Pangborn were here beside him. Since arriving in Castle Rock, he had come more and more to feel like Brer Rabbit stuck in the tar baby. What is it, Kay? We don't know yet. Not curare, because there was no paralysis until the very end. Also, curare is relatively painless, and Mr. Beaufort suffered a great deal. All we know right now is that it started slowly and then moved like a freight train. 10-4? That's all? 10-4. Jesus Christ, Ray Van Allen ejaculated. Isn't it enough? 10-4. Yes, I guess it is, Kay. Just be glad. Crackle, crackle, brack. Say again, Dr. Van Allen. Say again. 10-4. Through the swelling ocean of static, he heard Dr. Van Allen say, just be glad you've got the gun in custody, that you don't have to worry about it doing any more damage. 10-4. You got that right, buddy. 10-40 out. Thank you. Trusk, turned onto Main Street, and walked slowly toward Needful Things. She passed a bright yellow Ford Econoline van with WPTD Channel 5 Action News emblazoned on the side, but did not see Danforth, Buster, Keaton, looking out of the driver's window at her with unblinking eyes. She probably wouldn't have recognized him in any case. Buster had become, in a manner of speaking, a new man. And even if she had seen and recognized him, it would have meant nothing to Cora. She had her own problems and sorrows. Most of all, she had her own anger, and none of this concerned her dead son. In one hand, Cora Rusk held a pair of broken sunglasses. It had seemed to her that the police were going to question her forever, or at least until she went mad. "Go away," she wanted to scream at them. "Stop asking me all these stupid questions about Brian. Arrest him if he's in trouble. His father will fix it. Fixing things is all he's good for, but leave me alone. I've got a date with the king, and I can't keep him waiting." At one point, she had seen Sheriff Pangborn leaning in the doorway between the kitchen and the back stoop, his arms folded across his chest, and she had been on the verge of blurting this out, thinking he would understand. He wasn't like these others. He was from town. He would know about Needful Things. He would have bought his own special item there. He would understand. Except Mr. Gaunt had spoken up in her mind just then, as calm and as reasonable as ever. "No, Cora, don't talk to him. He wouldn't understand. He's not like you. He's not a smart shopper. Tell them you want to go to the hospital and see your other boy. That will get rid of them, at least for a while. After that, it won't matter." So she had told them just that, and it worked like a charm. She had even managed to squeeze out a tear or two, thinking not about Brian, but about how sad Elvis must feel, wandering around Graceland without her. Poor lost king. They had left, all but the two or three who were out in the garage. Cora didn't know what they were doing or what they could possibly want out there, and she didn't care. She grabbed her magic sunglasses off the table and hurried upstairs. Once she was in her room, she slipped out of her robe, lay down on her bed, and put them on. At once, she was in Graceland again. Relief, anticipation, and amazing horniness filled her. She swept up the curving staircase, cool and nude, to the upstairs hall, hung with jungle tapestries and nearly as wide as a freeway. She walked down to the closed double doors at the far end, her bare feet whispering in the deep nap of the carpet. She saw her fingers reach out and close around the handles. She pushed the doors open, revealing the king's bedroom. A room which was all black and white. Black walls, white shag rug, black drapes over the windows, white trim on the black bedspread, except for the ceiling, which was painted midnight blue with 1,000 twinkly electric stars. Then she looked at the bed, and that was when the horror struck. The king was on the bed, but the king was not alone. Sitting on top of him, riding him like a pony, was Myra Evans. She had turned her head and stared at Cora when the doors opened. The king only kept looking up at Myra, blinking those sleepy, beautiful blue eyes of his. "Myra!" Cora had exclaimed. "What are you doing here?" "Well," Myra said smugly, "I'm sure not vacuuming the floor." Cora gasped for breath, utterly stunned.
Well, I'll be butched!" she cried,
her voice rising as her wind returned. "Then go be butched," Myra said, pumping her hips faster, "and take those silly sunglasses off while you're at it. They look stupid. Get out of here. Go back to Castle Rock. We're busy, aren't we, E?"
"Oh, that's right, sweet thing," the king said. "Just as busy as two twiddly bugs in a carpet."
Horror turned to fury, and Cora's paralysis broke with a snap. She rushed at her so-called friend, meaning to rip her deceitful eyes from their sockets. But when she raised one clawed hand to do so, Myra reached out, never missing a stroke with her pumping hips as she did, and tore the sunglasses from Cora's face with her own hand. Cora had squeezed her eyes shut in surprise, and when she opened them, she had been lying in her own bed again. The sunglasses were on the floor, both lenses shattered.
"No!"
Cora moaned, lurching out of bed. She wanted to shriek, but some inner voice, not her own, warned her that the police in the garage would hear if she did, and come running.
"No, please, no, please, please!"
She tried to fit chunks of the broken lenses back into the streamlined gold frames, but it had been impossible. They were broken. Broken by that evil, whoring slut. Broken by her friend, Myra Evans. Her friend, who had somehow found her own way to Graceland. Her friend, who was even now, as Cora tried to put together a priceless artifact that was irretrievably broken, making love to the king. Cora looked up. Her eyes had become glittering black slits.
"I'll butch her," she had whispered hoarsely. "See if I don't."
She read the sign in the window of Needful Things, paused for a moment, thinking, and then walked around to the service alley. She brushed by Francine Pelletier, who was on her way out of the alley, putting something into her purse. Cora hardly even looked at her. Halfway down the alley, she saw Mr. Gaunt standing behind a wooden table, which lay across the open back door of his shop like a barricade.
"Ah, Cora," he exclaimed. "I was wondering when you'd drop by."
"That bitch!" Cora spat. "That double-crossing little slut bitch!"
"Pardon me, Cora," Mr. Gaunt said with urbane politeness, "but you seem to have missed a button or two." He pointed one of his odd and long fingers at the front of her dress. Cora had slipped the first thing she'd found in the closet on over her nakedness and had managed to do only the top button. Below that one, the dress gaped open to the curls of her pubic hair. Her belly, swelled by a great many ring-dings, yodels, and chocolate-covered cherries during Santa Barbara and all her other shows, curved smoothly out. "Who gives a shit?" Cora snapped.
"Not I," Mr. Gaunt agreed serenely.
"How may I help you?"
"That bitch is fucking the king. She broke my sunglasses. I want to kill her."
"Do you?" Mr. Gaunt said, raising his eyebrows. "Well, I can't say that I don't sympathize, Cora, because I do. It may be that a woman who would steal another woman's man deserves to live. I wouldn't care to say on that subject one way or the other. I've been a businessman all my life, and know very little about matters of the heart. But a woman who deliberately breaks another woman's most treasured possession, well, that is a much more serious thing. Do you agree?" She began to smile. It was a hard smile. It was a merciless smile. It was a smile utterly devoid of sanity. "Too fucking right," said Cora Rusk. Mr. Gaunt turned around for a moment. When he faced Cora again, he was holding an automatic pistol in one hand. "Might you be looking for something like this?" he asked. After Buster finished with Myrtle, he fell into a deep fugue state. All sense of purpose seemed to desert him. He thought of them. The whole town was crawling with them. But instead of the clear, righteous anger the idea had brought only minutes before, he now felt only weariness and depression. He had a pounding headache. His arm and back ached from wielding the hammer. He looked down and saw that he was still holding it. He opened his hand, and it fell to the kitchen linoleum, making a bloody splatter there. He stood looking at this splatter for almost a full minute with a kind of idiot attention. It looked to him like a sketch of his father's face, drawn in blood. He plodded through the living room and into his study, rubbing his shoulder and upper arm as he went. The handcuff chain jingled maddeningly. He opened the closet door, dropped to his knees, crawled beneath the clothes which hung at the front, and dug out the box with the pacers on the front. He backed clumsily out of the closet again, the handcuff caught in one of Myra's shoes, and he threw it to the back of the closet with a sulky curse, took the box over to his desk, and sat down with it in front of him. Instead of excitement, he felt only sadness. Winning ticket was wonderful, all right, but what good could it possibly do him now? It didn't matter if he put the money back or not. He had murdered his wife. She had undoubtedly deserved it, but they wouldn't see it that way. They would happily throw him into the deepest, darkest Shawshank penitentiary cell they could find and throw away the key. He saw that he had left large, bloody smears on the box top, and he looked down at himself. For the first time, he noticed that he was covered with blood. His meaty forearms looked as though they belonged to a Chicago hog butcher. Depression folded over him again in a soft, black wave. They had beaten him. Okay. Yet he would escape them. He would escape them just the same. He got up, weary to his very center, and plodded slowly upstairs. He undressed as he went, kicking off his shoes in the living room, dropping his pants at the foot of the stairs, then sitting down halfway up to peel off his socks. Even they were bloody. The shirt gave him the hardest time. Pulling off a shirt while you were wearing a handcuff was the devil's own job. Almost 20 minutes passed between the murder of Mrs. Keaton and Buster's trudge to and through the shower. He might have been taken into custody without a problem at almost any time during that period. But on Lower Main Street, a transition of authority was going on. The sheriff's office was in almost total disarray, and the whereabouts of Danforth, Buster, Keaton simply did not seem very important. Once he had toweled dry, he put on a clean pair of pants and a T-shirt. He didn't have the energy to tussle again with long sleeves, and went back down to his office. Buster sat in his chair and looked at winning ticket again, hoping that his depression might prove to be just an ephemeral thing, that some of his earlier joy might return. But the picture on the box seemed to have faded, dulled. The brightest color in evidence was a smear of Myrtle's blood across the flanks of the two-horse. He took the top off and looked inside. He was shocked to see that the little tin horses were leaning sadly every which way. Their colors had also faded. A broken bit of spring poked through the hole where you inserted the key to wind the machinery. "Someone's been in here," his mind cried. "Someone's been at it. One of them. Ruining me wasn't enough. They had to ruin my game, too." But a deeper voice, perhaps the fading voice of sanity, whispered that this was not true. "This is how it was from the very start," the voice whispered. "You just didn't see it." He went back to the closet, meaning to take down the gun after all. It was time to use it. He was feeling around for it when the telephone rang. Buster picked it up very slowly, knowing who was on the other end. Nor was he disappointed. "Hello, Dan," said Mr. Gaunt. "How are you this fine evening?"
"Terrible," Buster said in a glum, draggy voice. "The world has turned to boogers. I'm going to kill myself."
"Oh?" Mr. Gaunt sounded a trifle disappointed, nothing more. "Nothing's any good. Even the game you sold me is no good."
"Oh, I doubt that very much," Mr. Gaunt replied with a touch of asperity. "I check all my merchandise very carefully, Mr. Keaton, very carefully indeed. Why don't you look again?"
Buster did, and what he saw astounded him. The horses stood up straight in their slots. Each coat looked freshly painted and glistening. Even their eyes seemed to spark fire. The tin race course was all bright greens and dusty summer browns.
"The track looks fast," he thought dreamily, and his eyes shifted to the box top.
Either his eyes, dulled by his deep depression, had tricked him, or the colors there had deepened in some amazing way in the few seconds since the telephone had rung. Now it was Myrtle's blood he could barely see. It was drying to a drab maroon.
"My God," he whispered.
"Well," Mr. Gaunt asked, "well, Dan, am I wrong? Because if I am, you must defer your suicide at least long enough to return your purchase to me for a full refund. I stand behind my merchandise. I have to, you know. I have my reputation to protect, and that's a proposition I take very seriously in a world where there's billions of them and only one of me."
"No, no,"
Buster said. It's beautiful." "Then you were in error?" Mr. Gaunt persisted.
I guess I must have been."
"You admit you were in error?"
Yes."
"Good," Mr. Gaunt said. His voice lost its edge. "Then, by all means, go ahead and kill yourself. Although I must admit I'm disappointed. I thought I had finally met a man who had guts enough to help me kick their asses. I guess you're just a talker, like all the rest." Mr. Gaunt sighed. It was the sigh of a man who realizes he has not glimpsed light at the end of the tunnel after all. A strange thing was happening to Buster Keaton. He felt his vitality and purpose surging back. His own interior colors seemed to be brightening, intensifying again.
"You mean it's not too late?
You must have skipped Poetry 101. 'Tis never too late to seek a newer world. Not if you're a man with some spine. Why, I had everything all set up for you, Mr. Keaton. I was counting on you, you see."
"I liked plain old Dan a lot better," Buster said, almost shyly.
"All right, Dan."
Are you really set on making such a cowardly exit from life?
No, Buster cried. It's just, I thought, what's the use? There's too many of them.
Three good men can do a lot of damage, Dan.
Three? Did you say three?
Yes, there's another of us. Someone else who sees the danger, who understands what they are up to.
Who?
Buster asked eagerly.
Who?
In time, Mr. Gaunt said, but for now, time is in short supply.
They'll be coming for you.
Buster looked out the study window with the narrowed eyes of a ferret which smells danger on the wind. The street was empty, but only for the time being. He could feel them, sense them massing against him.
What should I do?
Then you're on my team, Mr. Gaunt asked. I can count on you, after all?
Yes.
All the way?
Till hell freezes over, or you say different.
Very good, Mr. Gaunt said. Listen carefully, Dan. And as Mr. Gaunt talked and Buster listened, gradually sinking into that hypnotic state which Mr. Gaunt seemed to induce at will, the first rumbles of the approaching storm had begun to shake the air outside. 5 minutes later, Buster left his house. He had put a light jacket on over his T-shirt and stuffed the hand with the cuff still on it deep into one of his pockets. Halfway down the block, he found a van parked against the curb, just where Mr. Gaunt had told him he would find it. It was bright yellow, a guarantee most passers-by would look at the paint instead of the driver. It was almost windowless, and both sides were marked with the logo of a Portland TV station. Buster took a quick but careful look in both directions, then got in. Mr. Gaunt had told him the keys would be under the seat. They were. Sitting on the passenger seat was a paper shopping bag. In it, Buster found a blonde wig, a pair of yuppie wire-rimmed glasses, and a small glass bottle. He put the wig on with some misgivings. Long and shaggy, it looked like the scalp of a dead rock singer. But when he looked at himself in the van's rearview mirror, he was astounded by how well it fit. It made him look younger, much younger. The lenses of the yuppie spectacles were clear glass, and they changed his appearance, at least in Buster's opinion, even more than the wig. They made him look smart, like Harrison Ford in The Mosquito Coast. He stared at himself in fascination. All at once, he looked 30-something instead of 52, like a man who might very well work for a TV station. Not as a news correspondent, nothing glamorous like that, but perhaps as a cameraman or even a producer. He unscrewed the top of the bottle and grimaced. The stuff inside smelled like a melting tractor battery. Tendrils of smoke rose from the mouth of the bottle.
Got to be careful with this stuff, Buster thought. Got to be real careful.
He put the empty cuff under his right thigh and pulled the chain taut. Then he poured some of the bottle's contents on the chain just below the cuff on his wrist, being careful not to drip any of the dark, viscous liquid on his skin. The steel immediately began to smoke and bubble. A few drops struck the rubber floor mat, and it also began to bubble. Smoke and a horrid frying smell rose from it. After a few moments, Buster pulled the empty cuff out from under his thigh, hooked his fingers through it, and yanked briskly. The chain parted like paper, and he threw it on the floor. He was still wearing a bracelet, but he could live with that. The chain and the swinging empty cuff had been the real pain in the keister. He slotted the key in the ignition, started the engine, and drove away. Not 3 minutes later, a Castle County sheriff's car driven by Seton Thomas turned into the driveway of the Keaton home. An old seat discovered Myrtle Keaton sprawled half in and half out of the doorway between the garage and the kitchen. Not long after, his car was joined by 4 state police units. The cops tossed the house from top to bottom, looking for either Buster or some sign of where he might have gone. No one gave the game sitting on his study desk a second glance. It was old, dirty, and obviously broken. It looked like something that might have come out of a poor relation's attic. Eddie Warburton, the janitor at the municipal building, had been pissed off at Sonny Jacket for more than 2 years. Over the last couple of days, this anger had built into a red rage. When the transmission of Eddie's neat little Honda Civic had seized up during the summer of 1989, Eddie hadn't wanted to take it to the nearest Honda dealership. That would have involved a large towing fee. Bad enough that the tranny hadn't expired until 3 weeks after the drivetrain warranty had done the same thing. So he had gone to Sonny Jacket first, had asked Sonny if he had any experience working on foreign cars.
Sonny told him he did. He spoke in that expansive, patronizing way most backcountry Yankees had of talking to Eddie. "We're not prejudiced, boy," that tone said. "This is the North, you know. We don't hold with all that Southern crap. Of course you're a nigger. Anyone can see that, but it don't mean a thing to us. Black, yellow, white, or green, we rook 'em all like you never seen. Bring it on in here." Sonny had fixed the Honda's transmission, but the bill had been $100 more than Sonny had said it would be, and they'd almost gotten into a fistfight over it one night at the Tiger. Then Sonny's lawyer, Yankees or crackers, it was Eddie Warburton's experience that all white men had lawyers, called Eddie and told him Sonny was going to take him to small claims court. Eddie ended up $50 out of pocket as a result of that little experience, and the fire in the Honda's electrical system happened 5 months later. The car had been parked in the municipal building's lot. Someone had yelled to Eddie, but by the time he got outside with a fire extinguisher, the interior of his car was a dancing mass of yellow fire. It had been a total loss. He'd wondered ever since if Sonny Jacket had set that fire. The insurance investigator said it was a bona fide accident, which had been caused by a short circuit, a one-in-a-million type of thing. But what did that fellow know? Probably nothing, and besides, it wasn't his money. Not that the insurance had been enough to cover Eddie's investment. And now he knew. He knew for sure. Earlier today, he'd gotten a little package in the mail. The items inside had been extremely enlightening. A number of blackened alligator clips, an old lop-eared photograph, and a note. The clips were of the sort a man could use to start an electrical fire. One simply stripped the insulation from the right pairs of wires in the right places, clipped the wires together, and voila! The snapshot showed Sonny and a large number of his white-bread friends, the fellows who were always lounging on kitchen chairs in the gas station office when you went down there. The location was not Sonny Sunoco, however. It was Robichaud's junkyard out on Town Road No. 5. The honkies were standing in front of Eddie's burned-out Civic, drinking beer, laughing, and eating chunks of watermelon. The note was short and to the point. "Dear nigger, fucking with me was a bad mistake." At first, Eddie wondered why Sonny would send him such a note, although he did not relate it to the letter he himself had slipped through Polly Chalmers's mail slot at Mr. Gaunt's behest. He decided it was because Sonny was even dumber and meaner than most honkies. Still, if the business was still rankling in Sonny's guts, why had he waited so long to reopen it? But the more he brooded over those old times, "dear nigger," the less the question seemed to matter. The note and the blackened alligator clips and that old photograph got into his head, buzzing there like a cloud of hungry mosquitoes. Earlier tonight, he had bought a gun from Mr. Gaunt. The fluorescence in the Sunoco station's office threw a white trapezoid on the macadam of the service tarmac as Eddie pulled in, driving the second-hand Olds, which had replaced the Civic. He got out, one hand in his jacket pocket, holding the gun. He paused outside the door for a minute, looking in. Sonny was sitting beside his cash register in a plastic chair which was rocked back on its rear legs. Eddie could just see the top of Sonny's cap over his open newspaper, reading the paper. Of course. White men always had lawyers, and after a day of shafting black fellows like Eddie, they always sat in their offices, rocked back in their chairs, and reading the paper. Fucking white men with their fucking lawyers and their fucking newspapers. Eddie drew the automatic pistol and went inside. A part of him, which had been asleep, suddenly woke up and screamed in alarm that he shouldn't do this. It was a mistake. But the voice didn't matter. It didn't matter because suddenly Eddie didn't seem to be inside himself at all. He seemed to be a spirit hovering over his own shoulder, watching all this happen. An evil imp had taken his controls. "I got something for you, you cheating some bitch," Eddie heard his mouth say, and watched his finger pull the trigger of the automatic twice. Two small black circles appeared in a headline which said, "McKernan approval rating soars." Sonny Jacket screamed and jerked. The rear legs of the tip-back chair skidded, and Sonny went tumbling to the floor with blood soaking into his coverall. Except the name stitched on the coverall in gold thread was Ricky. It wasn't Sonny at all, but Ricky Bissonette. "Ah, shit!" Eddie screamed. "I shot the wrong fucking honky!" "Hello, Eddie," Sonny Jacket remarked from behind him. "Good thing for me I was in the shithouse, wasn't it?" Eddie began to turn. Three bullets from the automatic pistol Sonny had bought from Mr. Gaunt late that afternoon entered his lower back, pulverizing his spine before he could get even halfway around. He watched, eyes wide and helpless, as Sonny bent down toward him. The muzzle of the gun Sonny held was as big as the mouth of a tunnel and as dark as forever. Above it, Sonny's face was pale and set. A streak of grease ran down one cheek. "Planning to steal my new socket wrench set wasn't your mistake," Sonny said as he pressed the barrel of the automatic against the center of Eddie Warburton's forehead. "Writing and telling me you was going to do it, that was your mistake." A great white light, the light of understanding, suddenly went on in Eddie's mind. Now he remembered the letter he had pushed through the Chalmers woman's mail slot, and he found himself able to put that piece of mischief together with the note he had received and the one Sonny was talking about.
"Listen," he whispered. "You have to listen to me, Jacket. We've been playing for suckers, both of us. We..."
"Goodbye, black boy," Sonny said, and pulled the trigger. Sonny looked fixedly at what remained of Eddie Warburton for almost a full minute, wondering if he should have listened to what Eddie had to say. He decided the answer was no. What could a fellow dumb enough to send a note like that have to say that could possibly matter? Sonny got up, walked into the office, and stepped over Ricky Bissonette's legs. He opened the safe and took out the adjustable socket wrenches Mr. Gaunt had sold him. He was still looking at them, picking each one up, handling it lovingly, then putting it back into the custom case again, when the state police arrived to take him into custody. "Park at the corner of Birch and Main," Mr. Gaunt had told Buster on the telephone, "and just wait. I will send someone to you." Buster had followed these instructions to the letter. He had seen a great many comings and goings at the mouth of the service alley from his vantage point one block up. Almost all his friends and neighbors, it seemed to him, had a little business to do with Mr. Gaunt this evening. 10 minutes ago, the Rusk woman had walked down there with her dress unbuttoned, looking like something out of a bad dream. Then, not 5 minutes after she came back out of the alley, putting something in her dress pocket, the dress was still unbuttoned and you could see a lot, but who in his right mind, Buster wondered, would want to look? There had been several gunshots from farther up Main Street. Buster couldn't be sure, but he thought they came from the Sunoco station. State police cruisers came winding up Main from the municipal building, their blue lights flashing, scattering reporters like pigeons. Disguise or no disguise, Buster decided it would be prudent to climb into the back of the van for a little while. The state police cars roared by, and their whirling blue lights picked out something which leaned against the van's rear doors, a green canvas duffel bag. Curious, Buster undid the knot in the drawstring, pulled the mouth of the bag open, and looked inside. There was a box on top of the bag's contents. Buster took it out and saw the rest of the duffel was full of timers, hot point clock timers. There were easily 2 dozen of them. Their smooth white faces stared up at him like pupilless orphan Annie eyes. He opened the box he had removed and saw it was full of alligator clips, the kind electricians sometimes use to make quick connections. Buster frowned, and then, suddenly, his mind's eye saw an office form, a Castle Rock fund release form, to be exact, typed neatly into the space provided for goods and or services to be supplied were these words, 16 cases of dynamite. Sitting in the back of the van, Buster began to grin. Then he began to laugh. Outside, thunder boomed and rolled. A tongue of lightning licked out of the dragging belly of a cloud and jabbed down into Castle Stream. Buster went on laughing. He laughed until the van shook with it. "Them!" he cried, laughing. "Oh, boy, have we got something for them! Have we ever!" Henry Payton, who had come to Castle Rock to pull Sheriff Pangborn's smoking irons out of the fire, stood in the doorway of the Sunoco station's office with his mouth open. They had 2 more men down. One was white and one was black, but both were dead. A third man, the station owner, according to the name on his coverall, sat on the floor by the open safe with a dirty steel case cradled in his arms as if it were a baby. Beside him on the floor was an automatic pistol. Looking at it, Henry felt an elevator go down in his guts. It was the twin of the one Hugh Priest had used to shoot Henry Beaufort. Look, one of the officers behind Henry said in a quiet, awed voice. There's another one. Henry turned his head to look and heard the tendons in his neck creak. Another gun, a third automatic pistol, lay near the outstretched hand of the black guy. Don't touch him, he said to the other officers. Don't even get near him. He stepped over the pool of blood, seized Sonny Jacket by the lapels of his coverall, and pulled him to his feet. Sonny did not resist, but he clutched the steel case tighter against his breast. What went on here? Henry yelled into his face. What in God's name went on? Sonny gestured toward Eddie Warburton, using his elbow so he would not have to let go of the case. He came in. He had a gun. He was crazy. You can see he was crazy. Look what he did to Ricky. He thought Ricky was me. He wanted to steal my adjustables. Look. Sonny smiled and tilted the steel case so Henry could look at the jumble of rusty ironmongery inside. I couldn't let him do that, could I? I mean, these are mine. I paid for them, and they're mine. Henry opened his mouth to say something. He had no idea what it would have been, and it never got out. Before he could say the first word, there were more gunshots, this time from up on Castle View. Lenore Potter stood over the body of Stephanie Bonsaint with a smoking automatic pistol in her hand. The body lay in the flower bed behind the house, the only one the evil, vindictive bitch hadn't torn up on her previous two trips. You shouldn't have come back, Lenore said. She had never fired a gun in her life before, and now she had killed a woman. But the only feeling she had was one of grim exultation. The woman had been on her property, tearing up her garden. Lenore had waited until the bitch actually got going. Her mama hadn't raised any fools. And she had been within her rights, perfectly within her rights. Lenore, her husband called. He was leaning out of the upstairs bathroom window with shaving cream on his face. His voice was alarmed. Lenore! What's going on?
I shot a trespasser,
Lenore said calmly, without looking around. She placed her foot under the heavy weight of the body and lifted. Feeling her toe sink into the Bonsaint bitch's unresisting side gave her a sudden, mean pleasure.
It's Stephanie Bon...
The body rolled over. It was not Stephanie Bonsaint. It was that nice deputy sheriff's wife. She had shot Melissa Clutterbuck. Quite suddenly, Lenore Potter's Calava went past blue, past purple, past magenta. It went all the way to midnight black. Alan Pangborn sat looking down at his hands, looking past them into a darkness so black it could only be felt. It had occurred to him that he might have lost Polly this afternoon, not for just a little while, until this current misunderstanding was ironed out, but forever. And that was going to leave him with about 35 years to kill. He heard a small scuffing sound and looked up quickly. It was Miss Hendry. She looked nervous, but she also looked as if she had come to a decision. The Rusk boy is stirring, she said. He's not awake. They gave him a tranquilizer, and he won't be really awake for some time yet, but he is stirring. Is he? Alan asked quietly and waited. Miss Hendry bit at her lip and then pressed on. Yes. I'd let you see him if I could, Sheriff Pangborn, but I really can't. You understand, don't you? I mean, I know you have problems in your hometown, but this little boy is only 7.
Yes.
I'm going down to the calf for a cup of tea. Mrs. Evans is late. She always is, but she'll be here in a minute or two. If you went down to Sean Rusk's room, room 9, right after I leave, she probably wouldn't know you were here at all. Do you see?
Yes, Alan said gratefully.
Rounds aren't until 8, so if you were in his room, she probably wouldn't notice you. Of course, if she did, you would tell her that I followed hospital directives and refused you admission, that you snuck in while the desk was temporarily unattended, wouldn't you?
Yes, Alan said, you bet I would.
You can leave by the stairs at the far end of the corridor, if you went into Sean Rusk's room, that is, which, of course, I told you not to do. Alan stood up and impulsively kissed her cheek. Miss Hendry blushed.
Thanks, Alan said.
For what? I haven't done a thing. I believe I'll go get my tea now. Please sit right where you are until I'm gone, Sheriff. Alan obediently sat down again. He sat there, his head positioned between Simple Simon and the pieman, until the double doors had whooshed most of the way shut behind Miss Hendry. Then he got up and walked quietly down the brightly painted corridor with its litter of toys and jigsaw puzzles to room 9. Sean Rusk looked totally awake to Alan. This was the pediatric wing, and the bed he was in was a small one, but he still seemed lost in it. His body created only a small hump beneath the counterpane, making him seem like a disembodied head resting on a crisp white pillow. His face was very pale. There were purple shadows, almost as dark as bruises, beneath his eyes, which looked at Alan with a calm lack of surprise. A curl of dark hair lay across the center of his forehead like a comma. Alan took the chair by the window and pulled it to the side of the bed, where bars had been raised to keep Sean from falling out. Sean did not turn his head, but his eyes moved to follow him. "Hello, Sean," Alan said quietly. "How are you feeling?"
"My throat is dry,"
Sean said in a husky whisper. There was a pitcher of water and 2 glasses on the table by the bed. Alan poured a glass of water and bent with it over the hospital bars. Sean tried to sit up and couldn't do it. He fell back against the pillow with a small sigh that hurt Alan's heart. His mind turned to his own son, poor doomed Todd. As he slipped a hand beneath Sean Rusk's neck to help him sit up, he had a moment of hellish total recall. He saw Todd standing by the scout that day, answering Alan's goodbye wave with one of his own, and in the eye of memory a kind of nacreous failing light seemed to play around Todd's head, illuminating every loved line and feature. His hand shook. A little water spilled down the front of the hospital johnny Sean wore. "Sorry."
"It's okay,"
Sean replied in his husky whisper and drank thirstily. He almost emptied the glass. Then he burped. Alan lowered him carefully back down. Sean seemed a little more alert now, but there was still no luster in his eyes. Alan thought he had never seen a little boy who looked so dreadfully alone, and his mind tried once again to call up that final image of Todd. He pushed it away. There was work to be done here. It was distasteful work and damned ticklish in the bargain, but he felt more and more that it was also desperately important work. Regardless of what might be going on in Castle Rock right now, he felt increasingly sure that at least some of the answers lay here, behind that pale forehead and those sad, lusterless eyes. He looked around the room and forced a smile. "Boring room," he said.
"Yeah,"
Sean said in his low, husky voice.
"Totally dopey."
"Maybe a few flowers would liven it up," Alan said, and passed his right hand in front of his left forearm, deftly plucking the folding bouquet from its palming well beneath his watch band. He knew he was pressing his luck, but had decided, on the spur of the moment, to go for it anyway. He was almost sorry. 2 of the tissue paper blooms tore as he slipped the loop and popped the bouquet open. He heard the spring give a tired twang. It was undoubtedly the final performance of this version of the folding flower trick, but Alan did get away with it, just. And Sean, unlike his brother, was clearly amused and delighted in spite of his state of mind and the drugs perking through his system.
"Awesome. How'd you do that?"
"Just a little magic. Want them?" He moved to put the spray of tissue paper flowers in the water pitcher.
"No, they're just paper. Also, they're ripped in a few places."
Sean thought about this, apparently decided it sounded ungrateful, and added,
"Neat trick, though. Can you make them disappear?"
"I doubt it, son," Alan thought. Aloud, he said, "I'll try." He held the bouquet up so Sean could see it clearly, then curved his right hand slightly and drew it downward. He made this pass much more slowly than usual in deference to the sad state of the MacGuffin, and found himself surprised and impressed with the result. Instead of snapping out of sight, the way they usually did, the folding flowers seemed to disappear into his loosely curled fist like smoke. He felt the loosened, overstressed spring try to buckle and jam, but in the end it decided to cooperate one last time.
"That's really radical," Sean said respectfully, and Alan privately agreed.
It was a wonderful variation on a trick he'd wowed school kids with for years, but he doubted that it could be done with a new version of the folding flower trick. A brand new spring would make that slow, dreamy pass impossible. "Thanks," he said, and stowed the folding bouquet under his watch band for the last time.
If you don't want flowers, how about a quarter for the Coke machine? Alan leaned forward and casually plucked a quarter from Sean's nose. The boy grinned. Whoops, I forgot. It takes 75 cents these days, doesn't it? Inflation. Well, no problem. He pulled a coin from Sean's mouth and discovered a third one in his own ear. By then, Sean's smile had faded a little, and Alan knew he had better get down to business quickly. He stacked the three quarters on the low dresser beside the bed. For when you feel better, he said. Thanks, mister. You're welcome, Sean. Where's my daddy? Sean asked. His voice was marginally stronger now. The question struck Alan as odd. He would have expected Sean to ask first for his mother. The boy was, after all, only 7. He'll be here soon, Sean. I hope so. I want him. I know you do. Alan paused and said, Your mommy will be here soon, too. Sean thought about this, then shook his head slowly and deliberately. The pillowcase made little rustling noises as he did it. No, she won't. She's too busy. Too busy to come and see you? Alan asked. Yes, she's very busy. Mommy's visiting with the king. That's why I can't go in her room anymore. She shuts the door and puts on her sunglasses and visits with the king. Alan saw Mrs. Rusk responding to the state police who were questioning her. Her voice slow and disconnected, a pair of sunglasses on the table beside her. She couldn't seem to leave them alone. One hand toyed with them almost constantly. She would draw it back as if afraid someone would notice, and then, after only a few seconds, her hand would return to them again, seemingly on its own. At the time, he had thought she was either suffering from shock or under the influence of a tranquilizer. Now he wondered. He also wondered if he should ask Sean about Brian or pursue this new avenue. Or were they both the same avenue? You're not really a magician, Sean said. You're a policeman, aren't you?
Uh-huh.
Are you a state policeman with a blue car that goes really fast?
No, I'm a county sheriff. Usually I have a brown car with a star on the side, and it does go pretty fast, but tonight I'm driving my old station wagon, and I keep forgetting to trade in. Alan grinned. It goes really slow.
This sparked some interest. Why aren't you driving your brown policeman car?
So I wouldn't spook Jill Miss Lebersky or your brother, Alan thought. I don't know about Jill, but I guess it didn't work so well with Brian.
I don't really remember, he said. It's been a long day. Are you a sheriff like in Young Guns?
Uh-huh, I guess so. Sort of like that.
Me and Brian rented that movie and watched it. It was most totally awesome. We wanted to go see Young Guns 2 when it was at the Magic Lantern in Bridgeton last summer, but my mom wouldn't let us because it was an R picture. We ain't allowed to see R pictures, except sometimes our dad lets us watch them at home on the VCR. Me and Brian really liked Young Guns.
Sean paused, and his eyes darkened.
But that was before Brian got the card.
What card?
For the first time, a real emotion appeared in Sean's eyes. It was terror. The baseball card. The great special baseball card.
Oh?
Alan thought of the Playmate cooler and the baseball cards. Traders, Brian had called them, inside.
Brian liked baseball cards, didn't he, Sean?
Yes, that's how he got him. I think he must use different things to get different people.
Alan leaned forward. Who, Sean? Who got him?
Brian killed himself. I saw him do it. It was in the garage.
I know. I'm sorry.
Gross stuff came out of the back of his head. Not just blood. Stuff. It was yellow. Alan could think of nothing to say. His heart was pounding slowly and heavily in his chest. His mouth was as dry as a desert, and he felt sick to his stomach. His son's name clanged in his mind like a funeral bell rung by idiot hands in the middle of the night.
I wished he didn't, Sean said. His voice was strangely matter-of-fact, but now a tear rose in each of his eyes, grew, and spilled down his smooth cheeks.
We won't get to see Young Guns 2 together when they put it out for VCRs. I'll have to watch it by myself, and it won't be any fun without Brian making all his stupid jokes. I know it won't.
You loved your brother, didn't you? Alan said hoarsely. He reached through the hospital bars. Sean Rusk's hand crept into his, and then closed tightly upon it. It was hot and small, very small.
Yeah, Brian wanted to pitch for the Red Sox when he grew up. He said he was going to learn to throw a dead fish curve just like Mike Boddicker. Now he never will. He told me not to come any closer or I'd get the mess on me. I cried. I was scared.
It wasn't like a movie. It was just our garage.
I know, Alan said. He remembered Annie's car, the shattered windows, the blood on the seats, and big black puddles. That hadn't been like a movie either. Alan began to cry. I know, son.
He asked me to promise, and I did, and I'm going to keep it. I'll keep that promise all my life.
What did you promise, son?
Alan swiped at his face with his free hand, but the tears would not stop. The boy lay before him, his skin almost as white as the pillowcase on which his head rested. The boy had seen his brother commit suicide, had seen the brains hit the garage wall like a fresh wad of snot. And where was his mother?
Visiting with the king, he had said. She shuts the door and puts on her sunglasses and visits with the king. What did you promise, son?
I tried to swear it on Mommy's name, but Brian wouldn't let me. He said I had to swear on my own name, because he got hurt, too. Brian said he gets everyone who swears on anyone else's name. So I swore on my own name like he wanted, but Brian made the gun go bang anyway.
Sean was crying harder now, but he looked earnestly up at Alan through his tears.
It wasn't just blood, Mr. Sheriff. It was other stuff. Yellow stuff.
Alan squeezed his hand. I know, Sean.
What did your brother want you to promise? Maybe Brian won't go to heaven if I tell.
Yes, he will. I promise, and I'm a sheriff.
Do sheriffs ever break their promises?
They never break them when they're made to little kids in the hospital, Alan said. Sheriffs can't break their promises to kids like that.
Do they go to hell if they do?
Yes, Alan said. That's right. They go to hell if they do.
Do you swear Brian will go to heaven even if I tell? Do you swear it on your very own name?
On my very own name, Alan said.
Okay, Sean said. He made me promise I would never go to the new store where he got the great special baseball card. He thought Sandy Koufax was on that card, but that wasn't who it was. It was some other player. It was old and dirty, but I don't think Brian knew that.
Sean paused a moment, thinking, and then went on in his eerily calm voice.
He came home one day with mud on his hands. He washed off the mud, and later on I heard him in his room crying.
The sheets, Alan thought. Wilma's sheets. It was Brian.
Brian said Needful Things is a poison place, and he's a poison man, and I should never go there.
Brian said that? He said Needful Things?
Yes. Sean. He paused, thinking. Electric sparks were shooting through him everywhere, jigging and jagging in tiny blue splinters. What? Did your mother get her sunglasses at Needful Things?
Yes.
She told you that she did?
No. But I know she did. She wears the sunglasses, and that's how she visits with the king.
What king, Sean? Do you know?
Sean looked at Alan as though he were crazy. Elvis. He's the king.
Elvis, Alan muttered. Sure. Who else?
I want my father.
I know, honey. Just a couple more questions, and I'll leave you alone. Then you'll go back to sleep, and when you wake up, your father will be here, he hoped.
Sean, did Brian say who the poison man was?
Yes.
Mr. Gaunt, the man who runs the store. He's the poison man. Now his mind jumped to Polly. Polly after the funeral saying, I guess it was just a matter of finally meeting the right doctor. Dr. Gaunt. Dr. Leland Gaunt. He saw her holding out the little silver ball she'd bought in Needful Things so he could see it, but cupping her hand protectively over it when he put a hand out to touch it. There had been an expression on her face in that moment which was totally unlike Polly, a look of narrow suspicion and possessiveness. Then, later, speaking in a strident, shaky, tear-filled voice which was also totally unlike her, It's hard to find out. The face you thought you loved is only a mask. How could you go behind my back? How could you?
What did you tell her? He muttered. He was totally unaware that he had seized the counterpane of the hospital bed in one hand and was twisting it slowly into his clenched fist. What did you tell her, and how the hell did you make her believe it?
Mr. Sheriff, are you okay?
Alan forced himself to open his fist. Yes, fine. You're sure Brian said Mr. Gaunt, aren't you, Sean?
Yes.
Thank you, Alan said.
He bent over the bars, took Sean's hand, and kissed his cool, pale cheek. Thank you for talking to me. He let go of the boy's hand and stood up. During the last week, there had been one piece of business on his agenda which simply hadn't gotten done. A courtesy call on Castle Rock's newest businessman. No big deal, just a friendly hello, a welcome to town, and a quick rundown on what the procedure was in case of trouble. He had meant to do it, had once even dropped by, but it kept not getting done. And today, when Polly's behavior began to make him wonder if Mr. Gaunt was on the up and up, the shit had really hit the fan, and he had wound up here, more than 20 miles away. Is he keeping me away? Has he been keeping me away all along? The idea should have seemed ridiculous, but in this quiet, shadowy room, it did not seem ridiculous at all. Suddenly he needed to get back. He needed to get back just as fast as he could. Mr. Sheriff? Alan looked down at him. Brian said something else, too, Sean said. Did he? Alan asked. What was that, Sean? Brian said Mr. Gaunt wasn't really a man at all. Alan walked down the hall toward the door with the exit sign over it, as quietly as he could, expecting to be frozen in his tracks by a challenging shout from Miss Hendry's replacement at any moment. But the only person who spoke to him was a little girl. She stood in the doorway of her room, her blonde hair tied in braids, which lay on the front of her faded pink flannel nightie. She was holding a blanket, her favorite, from its ragged, well-used look. Her feet were bare, the ribbons at the ends of her braids were askew, and her eyes were enormous in her haggard face. It was a face which knew more about pain than any child's face should know. "You've got a gun," she announced. "Yes." "My dad has a gun." "Does he?" "Yes, it's bigger than yours. It's bigger than the world. Are you the boogeyman?" "No, honey," he said, and thought, "I think maybe the boogeyman is in my hometown tonight." He pushed through the door at the end of the corridor, went downstairs, and pushed through another door into a late twilight as sultry as any midsummer evening. He hurried around to the parking lot, not quite running. Thunder bumbled and grumbled out of the west from the direction of Castle Rock. He unlocked the driver's door of the station wagon, got in, and pulled the Radio Shack microphone off its prongs. "Unit 1 to base, come back." His only response was a rush of brainless static. The goddamn storm. "Maybe the boogeyman ordered it up special," a voice whispered from somewhere deep inside. Alan smiled with his lips pressed together. He tried again, got the same response, then tried the state police in Oxford. They came through loud and clear. Dispatch told him there was a big electrical storm in the vicinity of Castle Rock and communications had become spotty. Even the telephones only seemed to be working when they wanted to. "Well, you get through to Henry Payton and tell him to take a man named Leland Gaunt into custody, as a material witness will do to begin with. That's Gaunt, G as in George. Do you copy? 10-4. "I copy you 5-by, Sheriff. Gaunt, G as in George. 10-4. Tell him I believe Gaunt may be an accessory before the fact in the murders of Nettie Cobb and Wilma Jerzyk. 10-4. Copy. 10-4. 10-40. Over and out. He replaced the mic, keyed the engine, and headed back toward the rock. On the outskirts of Bridgeton, he swerved into the parking lot of a Red Apple store and used the telephone to dial his office. He got 2 clicks and then a recorded voice telling him the number was temporarily out of service. He hung up and went back to his car. This time he was running. Before he pulled out of the parking lot and back onto Route 117, he turned on the porta bubble and stuck it on the roof again. By the time he was half a mile down the road, he had the shuddering, protesting Ford wagon doing 75. Ace Merrill and Full Dark returned to Castle Rock together. He drove the Chevy Celebrity across Castle Stream Bridge while thunder rolled heavily back and forth in the sky overhead and lightning jabbed the unresisting earth. He drove with the windows open. There was still no rain falling and the air was as thick as syrup. He was dirty and tired and furious. He had gone to 3 more locations on the map in spite of the note, unable to believe what had happened, unable to believe it could have happened. To coin a phrase, he was unable to believe he had been aced out. At each one of the spots, he had found a flat stone and a buried tin can. Two had contained more wads of dirty trading stamps. The last, in the marshy ground behind the Strout farm, had contained nothing but an old ballpoint pen. There was a woman with a 40s hairdo on the pen's barrel. She was wearing a 40s tank-style bathing suit as well. When you held the pen up, the bathing suit disappeared. Some treasure. Ace had driven back to Castle Rock at top speed, his eyes wild and his jeans splattered with swamp goo up to the knees, for one reason and one reason only, to kill Alan Pangborn. Then he would simply haul ass for the West Coast. He should have done it long before. He might get some money out of Pangborn. He might get none of it. Either way, one thing was certain. That son of a bitch was going to die, and he was going to die hard. Still 3 miles from the bridge, he realized that he didn't have a weapon. He had meant to take one of the autos from the crate in the Cambridge garage, but then that damn tape recorder had started up, scaring the life out of him. But he knew where they were. Oh, yes. He crossed the bridge and then stopped at the intersection of Main Street and Watermill Lane, although the right-of-way was his. What the fuck? He muttered. Lower Main was a tangled confusion of state police cruisers, flashing blue lights, TV vans, and little knots of people. Most of the action was swirling around the municipal building. It looked almost as though the town fathers had decided to throw a street carnival on the spur of the moment. Ace didn't care what had happened. The whole town could dry up and blow away as far as he was concerned. But he wanted Pangborn, wanted to tear the fucking thief's scalp off and hang it on his belt. And how was he supposed to do that with what looked like every state cop in Maine hanging out at the sheriff's office? The answer came at once. Mr. Gaunt will know. Mr. Gaunt has the artillery, and he'll have the answers to go with it. Go see Mr. Gaunt. He glanced in his mirror and saw more blue lights top the nearest rise on the other side of the bridge. Even more cops on the way. What the fuck happened here this afternoon? He wondered again. But that was a question which could be answered another time, or not at all, if that was how things fell out. Meantime, he had his own business, and it began with getting out of the way before the arriving cops rear-ended him. Ace turned left on Watermill Lane, then right onto Cedar Street, skirting the downtown area before cutting back to Main Street. He paused at the stoplight for a moment, looking at the nest of flashing blue lights at the bottom of the hill. Then he parked in front of Needful Things. He got out of the car, crossed the street, and read the sign in the window. He felt a moment of crashing disappointment. It was not just a gun he needed, but a little more of Mr. Gaunt's blow as well. And then he remembered the service entrance in the alley. He walked up the block and around the corner, not noticing the bright yellow van parked 20 or 30 yards farther up, or the man who sat inside it. Buster had moved to the passenger seat now, watching him. As he entered the alley, he bumped into a man who was wearing a tweed cap pulled low over his forehead. "Hey, watch where you're going, Daddy-O," Ace said. The man in the tweed cap raised his head, bared his teeth at Ace, and snarled. At the same moment, he pulled an automatic from his pocket and pointed it in Ace's general direction. "Don't fuck with me, my friend, unless you want some, too." Ace raised his hands and stepped back. He was not afraid. He was utterly astonished. "Not me, Mr. Nelson," he said. "Leave me out of it." "Right," the man in the tweed cap said. "Have you seen that cocksucker Jewett?" "Ah, the one from the junior high?" "The middle school, right. Are there any other Jewetts in town? Get real, for Christ's sake." "I just got here," Ace said cautiously. "I really haven't seen anyone, Mr. Nelson." "Well, I'm going to find him, and he's going to be one sorry sack of shit when I do. He killed my parakeet and shit on my mother." George T. Nelson narrowed his eyes and added, "This is a good night to stay out of my way." Ace didn't argue. Mr. Nelson stuffed the gun back into his pocket and disappeared around the corner, walking with the purposeful strides of one who is indeed highly pissed off. Ace stood right where he was for a moment, hands still raised. Mr. Nelson taught wood shop and metal shop at the high school. Ace had always believed he was one of those guys who wouldn't have the nerve to slap a deer fly if it lit on his eyeball, but he thought he might just have to change his opinion on that. Also, Ace recognized the gun. He should have. He had brought a whole case of them back from Boston just the night before.
"Ace," Mr. Gaunt said, "you're just in time."
"I need a gun," Ace said. "Also, some more of that high-class booger juice, if you've got any."
"Yes, yes, in time.
All things in time. Help me with this table, Ace.
I'm going to kill Pangborn, Ace said. He stole my fucking treasure, and I'm going to kill him.
Mr. Gaunt looked at Ace with the flat yellow stare of a cat stalking a mouse, and in that moment Ace felt like a mouse.
Don't waste my time telling me things I already know, he said. If you want my help, Ace, help me.
Ace grabbed one side of the table, and they carried it back into the storeroom. Mr. Gaunt bent down and picked up a sign which leaned against the wall. This time I'm really closed, it read. He put it on the door and then shut it. He was turning the thumb lock before Ace realized there had been nothing on the sign to hold it in place. No tack, no tape, no nothing. But it had stayed up just the same. Then his eye fell upon the crates which had contained the automatic pistols and the clips of ammunition. There were only 3 guns and 3 clips left.
Holy Jesus, where'd they all go?
Business has been good this evening, Ace, Mr. Gaunt said, rubbing his long-fingered hands together. Extremely good, and it's going to get even better. I have work for you to do.
I told you, Ace said. The sheriff stole my...
Leland Gaunt was upon him before Ace even saw him move. Those long, ugly hands seized him by the front of the shirt and lifted him into the air as if he were made of feathers. A startled cry fell out of his mouth. The hands which held him were like iron. Mr. Gaunt lifted him high, and Ace suddenly found himself looking down into that blazing, hellish face with only the haziest idea of how he had gotten there. Even in the extremity of his sudden terror, he noticed that smoke, or perhaps it was steam, was coming out of Mr. Gaunt's ears and nostrils. He looked like a human dragon.
You tell me nothing!
Mr. Gaunt screamed up at him. His tongue licked out between those jostling tombstone teeth, and Ace saw it came to a double point like the tongue of a snake.
I tell you everything! Shut up when you are in the company of your elders and betters, Ace! Shut up and listen! Shut up and listen! Shut up and listen!
He whirled Ace twice around his head like a carnival wrestler giving his opponent an airplane spin and threw him against the far wall. Ace's head connected with the plaster. A large fireworks display went off in the center of his brain. When his vision cleared, he saw Leland Gaunt bearing down on him. His face was a horror of eyes and teeth and blowing steam.
No!
Ace shrieked.
No, Mr. Gaunt, please! No!
The hands had become talons, the nails grown long and sharp in a moment's time. Or were they that way all along, Ace's mind gibbered. Maybe they were that way all along and you just didn't see it. They cut through the fabric of Ace's shirt like razors, and Ace was jerked back up into that fuming face. Are you ready to listen, Ace? Mr. Gaunt asked. Hot blurts of steam stung Ace's cheeks and mouth with each word. Are you ready, or should I just unzip your worthless guts and have done with it?
Yes, he sobbed. I mean, no! I'll listen.
Are you going to be a good little errand boy and follow orders?
Yes.
Do you know what will happen if you don't?
Yes, yes, yes.
You're disgusting, Ace, Mr. Gaunt said. I like that in a person. He slung Ace against the wall. Ace slid down it into a loose kneeling position, gasping and sobbing. He looked down at the floor. He was afraid to gaze directly into the monster's face. If you should even think of going against my wishes, Ace, I'll see to it that you get the grand tour of hell. You'll have the sheriff, don't worry. For the moment, however, he is out of town. Now, stand up. Ace got slowly to his feet. His head throbbed, his T-shirt hung in ribbons. Let me ask you something. Mr. Gaunt was urbane and smiling again, not a hair out of place. Do you like this little town? Do you love it? Do you keep snapshots of it on the walls of your shitty little shack to remind yourself of its rustic charm on those days when the bee stings and the dog bites?
Hell no, Ace said in an unsteady voice.
His voice rose and fell with the pounding of his heart. He made it to his feet only with the greatest effort. His legs felt as if they were made of spaghetti. He stood with his back to the wall, watching Mr. Gaunt warily. Would it appall you if I said I wanted you to blow this shitty little burg right off the face of the map while you wait for the sheriff to come back? I don't know what that word means, Ace said nervously. I'm not surprised.
but I think you understand what I mean, Ace, don't you? Ace thought back. He thought back all the way to a time, many years ago, when four snot-nosed kids had cheated him and his friends. Ace had had friends back in those days, or at least a reasonable approximation thereof, out of something Ace had wanted. They had caught one of the snot-noses, Gordy LaChance, later on, and had beaten the living shit out of him, but it hadn't mattered. These days, LaChance was a big-shot writer living in another part of the state, and he probably wiped his ass with $10 bills. Somehow, the snot-noses had won, and things had never been the same for Ace after that. That was when his luck had turned bad. Doors that had been open to him had begun to close, one by one. Little by little, he had begun to realize that he was not a king, and Castle Rock was not his kingdom. If that had ever been true, those days had begun to pass that Labor Day weekend when he was 16, when the snots had cheated him and his friends out of what was rightfully theirs. By the time Ace was old enough to drink legally in the Mellow Tiger, he had gone from being a king to being a soldier without a uniform, skulking through enemy territory. "I hate this fucking toilet," he said to Leland Gaunt. "Good," Mr. Gaunt said. "Very good. I have a friend. He's parked just up the street, who's going to help you do something about that, Ace. You'll have the sheriff, and you'll have the whole town, too. Does that sound good?" He had captured Ace's eyes with his own. Ace stood before him in the tattered rags of his T-shirt and began to grin. His head no longer ached. "Yeah," he said. "It sounds absolutely T-fine." Mr. Gaunt reached into his coat pocket and brought out a plastic sandwich bag filled with white powder. He held it out to Ace. "There's work to do, Ace," he said. Ace took the sandwich bag, but it was still Mr. Gaunt's eyes he looked at and into. "Good," he said. "I'm ready." Buster watched as the last man he had seen enter the service alley came back out again. The guy's T-shirt hung in ragged strips now, and he was carrying a crate. Tucked into the waistband of his blue jeans were the butts of two automatic pistols. Buster drew back in sudden alarm as the man, whom he now recognized as John Ace Merrill, walked directly to the van and set the crate down. Ace tapped on the glass. "Open up the back, Daddy-o," he said. "We got work to do." Buster unrolled his window. "Get out of here," he said. "Get out, you ruffian, or I'll call the police." "Good fucking luck," Ace grunted. He drew one of the pistols from the waistband of his pants. Buster stiffened, and then Ace thrust it through the window at him, butt first. Buster blinked at it. "Take it," Ace said impatiently, "and then open up the back. If you don't know who sent me, you're even dumber than you look." He reached out with his other hand and felt the wig. "Love your hair," he said with a small smile. "Simply marvelous." "Stop that," Buster said, but the anger and outrage had gone out of his voice. "Three good men can do a lot of damage," Mr. Gaunt had said. "I will send someone to you." But Ace? Ace Merrill? He was a criminal. "Look," Ace said, "if you want to discuss the arrangements with Mr. Gaunt, I think he might still be in there, but as you can see..." He fluttered his hands through the long strips of T-shirt hanging over his chest and belly. His mood is a little touchy. "You're supposed to help me get rid of them?" Buster asked. "That's right," Ace said. "We're going to turn this whole town into a flame-broiled whopper." He picked up the crate. "Although I don't know how we're supposed to do any real damage with just one box of blasting caps. He said you'd know the answer to that one." Buster had begun to grin. He got up, crawled into the back of the van, and slid the door open on its track. "I believe I do," he said. "Climb in, Mr. Merrill. We've got an errand to run." "Where?" "The town motor pool to start with," Buster said. He was still grinning. The Reverend William Rose, who had first stepped into the pulpit of the United Baptist Church of Castle Rock in May of 1983, was a bigot of the first water, no question about it. Unfortunately, he was also energetic, sometimes witty in an odd, cruel way, and extremely popular with his congregation. His first sermon as leader of the Baptist flock had been a sign of things to come. It was called, "Why the Catholics Are Hellbound."
He had kept up in this vein, which was extremely popular with his congregation, ever since. The Catholics, he informed them, were blasphemous, misguided creatures who worshipped not Jesus, but the woman who had been chosen to bear him. Was it any wonder they were so prone to error on other subjects as well? He explained to his flock that the Catholics had perfected the science of torture during the Inquisition, that the Inquisitors had burned the true faithful at what he called the smoking stake, right up to the end of the 19th century, when heroic Protestants, Baptists mostly, had made them stop, that 40 different popes through history had annulled their own mothers and the sisters, and even their illegitimate daughters in unholy sexual congress, that the Vatican was built on the gold of Protestant martyrs and plundered nations. This sort of ignorant twaddle was hardly news to the Catholic Church, which has had to put up with similar heresies for hundreds of years. Many priests would have taken it in stride, perhaps even making gentle fun of it. Father John Brigham, however, was not the sort to take things in his stride. Quite the contrary. A bad-tempered, bandy-legged Irishman, Brigham was one of those humorless men who cannot suffer fools, especially strutting fools of Reverend Rose's stripe. He had borne Rose's strident Catholic baiting in silence for almost a year before finally cutting loose from his own pulpit. His homily, which pulled no punches at all, was called The Sins of Reverend Willie. In it, he characterized the Baptist minister as a psalm-singing jackass of a man who thinks Billy Graham walks on water and Billy Sunday sits at the right hand of God the Father Almighty. Later that Sunday, Reverend Rose and four of his largest deacons had paid a visit on Father Brigham. They were shocked and angered, they said, by the slanderous things Father Brigham had said. "You've got your nerve telling me to tone down," Father Brigham said, after a hard morning of telling the faithful that I serve the whore of Babylon. Color rose quickly in Reverend Rose's normally pale cheeks and overspread his mostly bald pate. He had never said anything about the whore of Babylon, he told Father Brigham, although he had mentioned the whore of Rome several times, and if the shoe fit, why, Father Brigham had just better slip his heel in and wear it. Father Brigham had stepped out of the rectory's front door with his fists bunched. "If you want to discuss this on the front walk, my friend," he said, "just ask your little Gestapo unit there to stand aside, and we'll discuss it all you want." Reverend Rose, who was 3 inches taller than Father Brigham, but perhaps 20 pounds lighter, stepped back with a sneer. "I would not to soil up my hands," he said. One of the deacons was Don Hemphill. He was both taller and heavier than the combative priest. "I'll discuss it with you if you want," he said. "I'll wipe the walk with your pope-loving, bog-trotting ass." Two of the other deacons, who knew Don was capable of just that, had restrained him in the nick of time. But after that, the rumble was on. Until this October, it had been mostly sub rosa, ethnic jokes and malicious chatter in the ladies and men's groups of the two churches, schoolyard taunting between children of the two factions, and, most of all, rhetorical grenades tossed from pulpit to pulpit on Sundays, that day of peace when, history teaches, most wars actually start. Every now and then there were ugly incidents. Eggs were thrown at the parish hall during a Baptist youth fellowship dance, and once a rock was winged through the living room window of the rectory, but it had mostly been a war of words. Like all wars, it had had both its heated moments and its lulls, but a steadily deepening anger had run through it since the day the Daughters of Isabella announced their plans for casino night. By the time Reverend Rose received the infamous Baptist Ratfuck card, it was probably too late to avoid a confrontation of some sort. The over-the-top crudity of the message only seemed to guarantee that when the confrontation came, it would be a wowser. The kindling had been laid. All that remained was for someone to strike a match and light the bonfire. If anyone had fatally underestimated the volatility of the situation, it was Father Brigham. He had known his Baptist counterpart would not like the idea of casino night. But he did not understand how deeply the concept of church-supported gaming enraged and offended the Baptist preacher. He did not know that Steamboat Willie's father had been a compulsive gambler who had abandoned the family on many occasions when the gambling fever took him, or that the man had finally shot himself in the back room of a dance hall after a losing night at craps. And the unlovely truth about Father Brigham was this: it probably would not have made any difference to him, even if he had known. Reverend Rose mobilized his forces. The Baptists began with a No Casino Night letter-writing campaign to the Castle Rock Call. Wanda Hemphill, Don's wife, wrote most of them herself, and followed up the letters with the Dice and the Devil posters. Betsy Vigue, Casino Night chairwoman and grand regent of the local Daughters of Isabella chapter, organized the counterattack. For the previous 3 weeks, the call had expanded to 16 pages to handle the resulting debate, except it was more of a shouting match than a reasonable airing of different views. More posters went up. They were just as quickly torn down again. An editorial urging temperance on both sides was ignored. Some of the partisans were having fun. It was sort of neat to be caught up in such a teapot tempest. But as the end drew near, Steamboat Willie was not having fun, and neither was Father Brigham. "I loathe that self-righteous little piece of shit," Brigham burst out at a surprised Albert Gendron on the day Albert brought in the infamous "Listen Up, You Mackerel Snapper" letter, which Albert had found taped to the door of his dental office. "Imagine that whore's son accusing good Baptists of such a thing!" Reverend Rose had spat at an equally surprised Norman Harper and Don Hemphill. That had been on Columbus Day, following a call from Father Brigham. Brigham had tried to read the mackerel snapper letter to Reverend Rose. Reverend Rose had, quite properly in the view of his deacons, refused to listen. Norman Harper, a man who outweighed Albert Gendron by 20 pounds and stood nearly as tall, was made uneasy by the shrill, almost hysterical quality of Rose's voice, but he didn't say so.
"I'll tell you what it is," he rumbled. "Old Father Bogtrotter's gotten a little nervous about that card you got at the parsonage, Bill, that's all. He's realized that was going too far. He figures if he says one of his buddy boys got a letter full of the same kind of filth, it'll spread the blame around."
"Well, it won't work!"
Rose's voice was shriller than ever.
"No one in my congregation would be party to such filth. No one!"
His voice splintered on the last word. His hands opened and closed convulsively. Norman and Don exchanged a quick, uneasy glance. They had discussed just this sort of behavior, which was becoming more and more common in Reverend Rose, on several occasions over the last few weeks. The casino night business was tearing Bill apart. The two men were afraid he might actually have a nervous breakdown before the situation was finally resolved.
"Don't you fret," Don said soothingly. "We know the truth of the thing, Bill."
"Yes,"
Reverend Rose cried, fixing the two men with a trembling, liquid gaze.
"Yes, you know. You, too. And I know. But what about the rest of this town? Do they know?"
Neither Norman nor Don could answer this.
"I hope someone rides the lying idol worshiper out on a rail,"
William Rose cried, clenching his fists and shaking them impotently.
"On a rail! I would pay to see that! I would pay handsomely!"
On Monday, Father Brigham had phoned around asking those interested in the current atmosphere of religious repression in Castle Rock to drop by the rectory for a brief meeting that evening. So many people showed up that the meeting had to be moved to the Knights of Columbus Hall next door. Brigham began by speaking of the letter Albert Gendron had found on his door, the letter purporting to be from the concerned Baptist men of Castle Rock, and then recounted his unrewarding telephone conversation with Reverend Rose. When he told the assembled group that Rose claimed to have received his own obscene note, a note which purported to be from the concerned Catholic men of Castle Rock, there was a rumble from the crowd, shocked at first, then angry.
"The man's a damned liar," someone called from the back of the room.
Father Brigham seemed to nod and shake his head at the same time. "Perhaps, Sam, but that's not the real issue. He is quite mad. I think that is the issue." Thoughtful, worried silence greeted this, but Father Brigham felt a sense of almost palpable relief just the same. Quite mad. It was the first time he had spoken the words aloud, although they had been circling in his mind for at least 3 years. "I don't want to be stopped by a religious nut," Father Brigham went on. "Our casino night is harmless and wholesome, no matter what the Reverend Steamboat Willie may think about it. But I feel, since he has grown increasingly strident and increasingly less stable, that we should take a vote. If you are in favor of canceling casino night, of bowing to this pressure in the name of safety, you should say so." The vote to hold casino night, just as planned, had been unanimous. Father Brigham nodded, pleased. Then he looked at Betsy Vigue. You're going to have a planning session tomorrow night, aren't you, Betsy?
Yes, Father.
Then may I suggest, Father Brigham said, that we men meet here at the KFC Hall at just the same time. Albert Gendron, a ponderous man who was both slow to anger and slow to recover from anger, got up slowly and stood to his full height, necks craned to follow his rise.
Are you suggesting those Baptist clunks might try to bother the ladies, Father?
No, no, not at all, Father Brigham soothed. But I think it might be wise if we discussed some plans to ensure that casino night itself goes smoothly.
Guards? Someone else asked enthusiastically. Guards, Father?
Well, eyes and ears, Father Brigham said, leaving no doubt at all that guards were what he meant. And if we meet Tuesday evening while the ladies are meeting, we'll be there, just in case there is trouble. So, while the Daughters of Isabella were gathering at the building on one side of the parking lot, the Catholic men were gathering at the building on the other. And across town, Reverend William Rose had called a meeting at this same time to discuss the latest Catholic slander and to plan the making of signs and the organizing of casino night picketers. The various alarms and excursions in the Rock that early evening did not dent attendance at these meetings very much. Most of the gawkers milling around the municipal building as the storm approached were people who were neutral in the great casino night controversy. As far as the Catholics and Baptists actually embroiled in the brouhaha were concerned, a couple of murders could not hold a candle to the prospect of a really good holy grudge match, because, after all, other things had to take a back seat when it came to questions of religion. Over 70 people showed up at the fourth meeting of what Reverend Rose had dubbed the Baptist Anti-Gambling Christian Soldiers of Castle Rock. This was a great turnout. Attendance had fallen off sharply at the last meeting, but rumors of the obscene card dropped through the parsonage mail slot had pumped it up again. The showing relieved Reverend Rose, but he was both disappointed and puzzled to realize that Don Hemphill wasn't in attendance. Don had promised he would be here, and Don was his strong right arm. Rose glanced at his watch and saw that it was already 7:05. No time to call the market and see if Don had forgotten. Everyone who was coming was here, and he wanted to catch them while their indignation and curiosity were at flood tide. He gave Hemphill one more minute, then mounted the pulpit and raised his skinny arms in a gesture of welcome. His congregation, dressed tonight in their working clothes for the most part, filed into the pews and sat down on the plain wooden benches. "Let us begin this endeavor, as all great endeavors are begun," Reverend Rose said quietly. "Let us bow our heads in a prayer." They dropped their heads, and that was when the vestibule door banged open behind them with gunshot force. A few of the women screamed, and several men leaped to their feet. It was Don. He was his own head butcher, and he still wore his blood-stained white apron. His face was as red as a beefsteak tomato. His wild eyes were streaming water. Runners of snot were drying on his nose, his upper lip, and the creases which bracketed his mouth. Also, he stank. Don smelled like a pack of skunks, which had been first run through a vat of sulfur, then sprayed with fresh cow shit, and finally let loose to rant and racket their panicky way through a closed room. The smell preceded him. The smell followed him. But mostly, the smell hung around him in a pestilential cloud. Women shrank away from the aisle and groped for their handkerchiefs as he stumbled past them, with his apron flapping in front and his untucked white shirt flapping behind. The few children in attendance began to cry. Men roared out cries of mingled disgust and bewilderment. "Don!" Reverend Rose cried in a prissy, surprised voice. His arms were still raised, but as Don Hemphill neared the pulpit, Rose lowered them and involuntarily clapped one hand over his nose and mouth. He thought he might vomit. It was the most incredible nose-buster of a stink he had ever encountered.
"What? What has happened?"
"Happened?" Don Hemphill roared. "Happened? I'll tell you what happened. I'll tell you all what happened." He wheeled on the congregation, and in spite of the stink which both clung to him and spread out from him, they grew still as his furious, maddened eyes fell upon them.
"The sons of bitches stink-bombed my store, that's what happened. There weren't more than half a dozen people there because I put up a sign saying I was closing early, and thank God for that, but the stock is ruined. All of it. $40,000 worth.
Ruined. I don't know what the bastards used, but it's going to stink for days.
Who? Reverend Rose asked in a timorous voice. Who did it, Don?
Don Hemphill reached into the pocket of his apron. He brought out a curved black band with a white notch in it and a stack of leaflets. The band was a Roman collar. He held it up for them all to see.
Who the hell do you think? He screamed. My store, my stock, all shot to hell, and who do you think?
He threw the leaflets at the stunned members of the Baptist anti-gambling Christian soldiers. They separated in the air and fluttered down like confetti. Some of those present reached out and grabbed at them. Each one was just the same. Each showed a crowd of laughing men and women standing around a roulette table. Just for fun, it said over the picture. And below it, join us for Casino Night at the Knights of Columbus Hall, October 31st, 1991, to benefit the Catholic Builders Fund.
Where did you find these pamphlets, Don? Len Milliken asked in a rumbling, ominous voice.
And this collar.
Somebody put them inside the main doors, Don said, just before everything went to heck.
The vestibule door boomed again, making them all jump, only this time it was not opening, but closing.
Hope you like the smell.